For a different age I was born, every man has once said. For each was to honour Swan, rather to all this cowardice bred. Thus for a gilded time we mourn, insisting such days forever dead. Yet of all the feelings ever known, longing for a time not your own is when true cowardice is shown, especially if dark the age has grown.
So welcome everybody to episode 52 of Strike and Mike. What's up, Striker?
Hey.
And joining us from the, we have a special guest for you guys today, joining us from the Testudo Legal Defense Network is Blackstone. So what's up, Blackstone? Say hi.
Hello, everybody.
All right. Thanks for coming on. So that's a very, if you want to explain what Testudo means to those of our sort of small-brained, non-military historian listeners, and then explain what it is that you are doing with the Testudo Legal Defense Organization.
Certainly. So the Testudo, everyone would recognize it if they saw it, I imagine. It's the Roman formation where they group up together really close and they put shields above them and all around their sides so that you know, arrows can't penetrate, spears can't penetrate, but it's still an attacking formation. So it's a tactically defensive, strategically offensive, formation. They use it to protect themselves as they push the enemy back. And the reason why I chose that is because that kind of encapsulates what I want the network to do. It's going to be essentially defensive. It's supposed to protect us. But the way it protects us is by being offensive. It protects us by engaging in civil litigation. That is, from the plaintiff side, that is to say the injured person side against those who have injured them. So in the case of our groups, if Antifa doxes you, if you are fired from your job, you have been injured, and the Testudo Legal Defense Network's purpose is to take your case and essentially pursue it against those people who have injured you, therefore basically creating a defensive shield because of a fear of being sued, which is what we would call a chilling effect in the legal sense. And essentially, from a law and economics point of view, increasing the transaction cost of engaging in things such as doxing, harassment, or otherwise attacking people with whom you do not agree because they're evil Nazis.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I can testify firsthand, I'm sure Striker can as well, that the chilling effect of the fear of doxing, of losing your employment, of having family members turn on you, things like this are extremely, they cause a lot of anxiety for people that have our beliefs or beliefs in the same sort of spectrum as ours. And so this is known by the enemy, and they use this tactic effectively to do kind of psychological warfare, pressure tactics, and they're trying to get everyone to retreat from the public space and not talk about their ideas and just kind of shut up and withdraw into themselves. So, cause that's, and they talk about this amongst themselves. Like, this is what they want. They want people to be too afraid to speak out, and doxing, and harassment is one of the main tools in their toolbox. And as well as, they will then themselves pursue, you know, frivolous, litigation as they did it in my case and is still ongoing. But yeah, you got something, sorry.
It's not just the doxing itself isn't really the problem. The problem is the accompanying harassment. You know, Antifa threatens your kids. You lose your job. It's really just the impact, a lot of it extra legal. Like, you know, it's not legal for anarchist paramilitary groups to be enacting some kind of Red Guard style political vigilantism. And this kind of, I think an important thing to focus on is the network and the pipeline, right? So it starts with the journalist, right? The Antifa sympathizing journalist who does the legwork. He's got the access to the databases, the LexisNexis and so on. He gets the personal information of people and then he puts it out there for Antifa to do the rest of the work. And I think, culturally speaking, as of late, there is a bit of a pushback against this. For example, the Covington students who are subjected to this process, they're subjected to the journalists on social media create the outrage. The Antifa take it up. People start to threaten their lives. They start to go to their school in Covington and intimidate them with, you know, real life, paramilitary presence and protests. And, the reaction to that has been actually quite heartening, because now their lawyer is actually suing the Washington Post for $250 million. Dollars.
Yes.
That's actually what Jeff Bezos paid for that fucking hive of kikes in 2013. So, Blackstone, what do you think of that lawsuit in respects to the greater legal paradigm?
So I'm happy to give you my opinion on the case, but could you please explain what you mean by impact on the greater legal paradigm?
Well, do you think this lawsuit could make history or precedent?
Sure. Well, I mean, certainly it can make precedent, right? Any case has the potential to make precedent. So one of the hardest things about proving things against journalism is that there's essentially a legal kind of shield they have where anything that's a public interest, they're allowed to comment on. And usually speaking, because this whole Covington thing blew up, you know, it was newsworthy. And they, I would imagine, depending on what they're suing under, if they're suing under defamation, then they're going to have to prove actual malice on behalf of the newspaper, which means that the journalists who were reporting on it either knew it wasn't true and reported it anyway, or were reckless in regards to that truth. Now, I haven't read the complaint, but if they're asking for $250 million, I imagine that a large part of that's going to be punitive damages, which means that they're doing other things in addition to defamation. I hope that they're suing them for harassment, because because that's the thing that more than anything else we need to really start getting points on the board for on our side, because it is not legal. Just simple, straight up. I mean, the people who are so victimized when it happens to them, they don't even think about the fact that what's being done to them is completely and utterly, without a doubt, outside of the bounds of the law. You are not allowed to hound someone to death. You are not allowed to release their private information. You are not allowed to release their address, because, in large part, because when you do it within the context of calling them an evil Nazi or any other number of horrible, horrible defamations, you're essentially saying, go hurt this person.
It's an imminent call to violence.
It's right. It's an incitement to her. It's an incitement to violence. It's an incitement to harassment. And it is completely – it is absolutely not protected in any way by the First Amendment. And it is so frustrating to me to watch these self-important fuckers just – like pat themselves on the back for essentially violating their precious First Amendment by going ahead and just personally attacking someone from their superior vantage point.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and the other thing about the in terms of the release of personal information, like, yeah, they oftentimes you won't see the media outlet themselves put out like the address, but there's a network of people that they work with. And here's how this works. And I learned this when I was involved in civil litigation as well. When a lot of people that I wanted to seek information from when I was being sued were journalists, and I knew they had the information, but of course journalists have another legal blanket, which makes them more immune to subpoena, which is they can protect sources, and they like more so than an average person. They can, there's a standard there where a journalist can say that's a source, and I have to protect them. So they have more ability to resist subpoenas, which is bullshit in some cases, particularly when we know that they are getting information and giving information from people that are inciting violence against targets, and they're working together in these harassment campaigns. So you'll get the Huffington Post comes out with an article about somebody, and then on an Antifa blog, Antifa will be the ones that post their personal information. Now we know that behind the scenes there's a lot of communication going on, but if you try to subpoena that front facing journalist by say, like, who are you talking to that's also doing this, then they're like, well, sorry, sources and methods, goy.
And yeah, I think another thing to look at here is the well-worn pattern. So, you know, it starts with a blue check mark threatening to kill you. Then Jim Carrey paints a picture of you.
Yeah.
Literally, he paints you.
Yeah, I know.
Like it's, with a target on your face.
Yeah, basically, and, yeah, some kind of.
And then the anarchists get it, and so on and so on. So I think one thing that I think should be explored as well is Twitter's liability. So someone did a study on how fast Twitter takes action. And there was a number of people during the Covington case that were outright calling for violence against these teenagers. Some people talking about putting them in wood chippers, yes. And other people talking about, hey, if you see this guy, punch him in the face and I'll give you a blowjob, right? You know, stuff like that. And
I hope the person that offered that was a girl.
It was. Yeah, it was
actually. And
she wasn't even hot. She's gross.
Yeah, yeah. So, but listen, if you're a soy boy, you're going to take what you can get.
Yeah.
Exactly. But the point is, though, is that Twitter took 48 hours to get rid of this stuff. These were major accounts, some of them with 100,000 followers, saying these things. Twitter took 48 hours to delete those comments, didn't ban the accounts. Meanwhile, on the other hand, when people were telling journos to learn to code,
oh yes,
Twitter banned them in 20 minutes. They actually timed it 20 minutes after some guy complained that someone hurt his feelings by telling him to learn to code. Twitter swooped in and banned that person. Didn't just delete the tweet, fully expunged them from the platform. So that in and of itself appears to be a kind of editorial line. Yeah. A publisher's editorial line that I think, you know, essentially you're endorsing the violence when you drag your feet.
If they're deleting, here's the thing, if they're deleting content, then they're not helpless to delete content. So if violent and defamatory content remains up despite lots of complaints, that's a decision that they're making. And I think that there's a possibility there for holding them liable. But I don't want to get too much into the speculative realm. I want Blackstone to tell us what concrete things can actually be done for a person, I guess it varies by state, that does get, say, doxxed and harassed. Like what kind of things can we look at immediately that they can do right away?
Okay, so there are actually a lot of things, and I hope you don't mind me taking a page out of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but the first thing is to don't panic.
Yes, absolutely.
The biggest thing is, you know, you have all this heat coming down on you, but if you literally shut off your computer and turn off your phone, nothing can touch you. I mean, like, that's it. You don't have to listen to anybody. You don't have to read anything. You just need to chill out and get a handle on things. Second of all, the news cycle is such that this is going to blow over. It will blow over fairly quickly. Yes, you're going to have your name dragged through your mud, but you know what? You can, like, there's absolutely no reason why you have to stand or fall based on what someone says about you online. If you are in a job interview and say, hey, we read that you were a Nazi, you could say, I don't know where that came from. That's completely insane. I'm not a Nazi. That was a lie. I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just because someone says something bad about you doesn't mean you have to own it for the rest of your life. Third, something that has happened in the past, and especially if you're part of an organization, is sometimes you will be visited by the fairies of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I don't mean that as a sexual slur. I mean that, like, as a joke. the fact of the matter is that they're coming because they're fishing. You don't have to tell them anything. The one thing you ought to say is this: am I being charged with a crime? Since you haven't committed a crime, unless you've been an idiot, then the answer will be no. Then you say, I have nothing to say without a lawyer present, and they will leave because there's not a damn thing they can do about it. Don't talk to the police. It will not help you. They're not your friend. They are here to serve the people who pay them. The people who pay them do not like you. Therefore, they will look for anything to screw you over.
Yeah.
I was recently talking to someone who's in this sort of trouble, and, you know, his statements to police, which were not much, were, you know, he was accused of lying to them. Well, despite the fact that what he said was technically correct, and they just expanded it to cover a whole mess of things that he didn't mean, and they can do that because they're like, here's the important thing for everyone to realize: the police have no obligation to tell you the truth unless they're charging you with a crime. They have to tell you if they're going to arrest you or not. But other than that, they can stay and say, listen, we have 10 people in the other room, all say that you shot JFK.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's you know, I think in dealings with the police or perhaps even federal agents, that's the most important thing to remember is, like, you have a right to an attorney. Even if you do get arrested, don't say anything until you have an attorney.
Especially if you're arrested.
Yeah, don't ever talk to them without an attorney present. There have been cases where people have they've come and they've been friendly and they're like, look, we don't like what's going on with Antifa, and if you could help us out a little bit, don't fall for that. We've learned that that's bullshit. That's them trying to just get you to start flapping your mouth. And the more that, you know, these are trained intelligence operatives. The more you flap your mouth, the more they're going to glean something out of what you say. So you got to be real careful. And the more you talk to someone, the more comfortable you'll get, and you'll drop your guard, and then all kinds of stuff will just start coming out of your mouth. They know how to get people to do this. They're trained in this. You're not smarter than they are.
They're essentially journalists with badges.
Yeah.
Nothing you say to them is going to come out well.
It's not going to go well.
Yeah. Like, you know, if you get into trouble where you have like anarchists firebombing your truck or something like that, like, I think it's somewhat okay to, you know, file a report with your local precinct. But, you know, when it comes to the FBI, this is just my opinion. You guys can disagree.
Yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing.
When it comes to the FBI, like, don't even bother with them. They're not going to help you. They just want to hurt you. The FBI is a political institution. I would argue an anti-white institution, indistinguishable from the SPLC. And, you know, just talking to them in any capacity, even to complain about being a victim of a crime, will just put you in hot water. They have a political agenda. They have to answer to people in Washington who are either nefarious themselves or they get money in envelopes from nefarious forces. So just keep that in mind. We live in a corrupt and broken country. So the smaller, the better. It's like with the media, right? It's different to talk to CNN, who are always going to try and railroad you and lie about you and destroy you, than it is to talk to maybe, and I don't even suggest this, but if it has to happen, like, you're going to get a fair shake from local media, from a local news affiliate. So local is better. Neither is ideal. But one thing for sure, never talk to the FBI or CNN under any capacity.
Basically, you should avoid any national organizations or institutions because they've been infiltrated. They are – all of them have an agenda. I mean – it doesn't even matter. I mean, hell, the Department of Education has an agenda that has nothing to do with education. The, you know, Department of Defense is filled with a bunch of, I mean, like, listen, they were more concerned about making sure that trainees could wear uniforms than they were about actually winning freaking wars. I mean, it's clown world, right? I mean, it's completely, utterly insane. And so I can guarantee you, I can promise you, that nothing will inure to your benefit by in any way engaging with the federal government outside of the absolute necessity that you're forced to.
Right. I think if you're a victim of a crime, like a direct crime, like someone comes to your house, you can call the police and report that.
That's not federal law enforcement. That's
yeah,
state, local.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. But never talk. Because if you do, I've heard, you know, rumors, stories of people that have thought they could report Antifa to the feds, and the feds do that. They take that contact as an opening in a further intelligence gathering operation that they're doing on people with dissident ideas. And remember, Antifa are not dissidents. So the FBI does not consider them political dissidents that they need to investigate and follow up on. They are not worried about Antifa in the slightest. They don't care. They're not going to enforce the law against them. They know what they do, and it's officially sanctioned from the highest levels of government. So they do not care. They're not interested. and you saying, hey, you know, this national terror network is harassing me, just means that Antifa has some intelligence on you that the FBI would like to get in on, and that they want to come and try and collect more intelligence from you, because essentially their on-the-ground network has picked you up, and now they're going to come in. That's what's going on. No, never even talking about Antifa. They don't care.
Antifa is essentially a unincorporated NGO, or basically one of the most effective counterintelligence networks ever devised by the federal government.
Yeah. Yep.
I wouldn't go that far. What I would say about Antifa, now, I think that it's a little exaggerated how much like George Soros pays them or the government controls them or whatever. What I think instead is that Antifa is like an irregular army, like ISIS or, you know, with shit like that. So like there's a kind of wink and nod agreement between the government and the Antifa. But without institutional support, the Antifa are nothing. And I don't think they have a fixed institutional support. These are little wind-up toys that they pulled out of the box specifically to help in suppressing nationalism and dissent.
Right.
Aside from that, once that's done, who knows? I mean, the FBI themselves, when they choose on their own time, if they feel Antifa becomes a liability to them, they might even go after them eventually. Like, you know, now that there's a kind of the elites seem to be more comfortable with Trump now. Who knows? You know, once election season starts and Antifa starts attacking Trump events, the FBI may actually step in. So, but they're going to do that on their own time, and it's not going to be because you reported them.
Okay? I frankly don't see the FBI going after the Antifa until we have been effectively destroyed and or oppressed, because insofar as Antifa is against the globalist agenda, they don't really – I don't know that they realize that they're actually working for globalism at this point, but because there's a lot of anti-globalists who are really confused about what that means on that side. But they're more than happy to attack evil Nazis, right? So they'll attack us, and then when we're effectively suppressed, that's when the globalists will go after.
That's the eternal fate of Marxists, right? Of ideologues is Marxist ideologues. Their eternal fate is to be killed by the regime they help bring into power. But that's kind of neither here nor there for the subject of legal stuff. Right now, Antifa is effectively. I think it is as Stryker described. A lot of them are total useful idiots. They don't even understand their own role. They think that, you know, anarcho-communism is an actual thing that matters, and they don't realize they're just allowed to LARP with that stupid ideology. As long as they're attacking nationalists, it doesn't matter. No one cares what you think. You're there to attack nationalists. That's it. You can read your little Bakunin books all you want. But I want to talk about what we're talking about what a victim can do in the immediate sense, and so that's very good, I think, to say, like, never talk to federal government. If you are the victim of actual direct crimes, I think you can report it to the local police. They have been helpful to some people in some cases, but again, be very careful about how you do that. Now, I want to ask you a question, Blackstone, and you can give me your opinion here. Now, there's a number of states where I believe New York and California specifically, where you can be protected in your employment for political or recreational activities that are not on the clock. New York and California have legislation like that. A lot of other states don't. They have this at-will employment thing. But there's another thing that a lot of states do have, which is called tortious interference. So yep. That if somebody... If you have a job, like you have a contract with your employer, tortious interference is where a third party that's not a party to a contract interferes in the contract in order to break it and damages one or both parties to the contract. So somebody basically going to your employer and saying, you know, we're going to – you have this guy working for you and he's bad. And, you know, you don't want the bad press, or even just calling and calling and calling to harass the employer and getting you fired. Now, the employer theoretically could be not liable for anything, but the people that were initiating their harassment against the employer can be held liable. So what's your opinion on that?
Here's my opinion on that. I'm putting together at least two suits right now with that exact theory.
Okay, great.
The tortious interference with the contract is a tort. Which is against a, like you said, the third party who interferes with the, you know, who improperly interferes with or sees or essentially causes one or both parties to break a contract. And just because something is at will doesn't mean a contract doesn't exist, right?
Yeah.
You underneath that contract have certain rights and responsibilities. Like at will doesn't mean like you can show up for work whenever you feel like it because, right. So here's the thing. If you break a contract because of a tortious interference, so if an employer breaks a contract because of tortious interference from a third party, they have wrongfully terminated that contract, and you can sue them under that theory. So you can sue the employer for wrongful termination, and you can sue the third party for tortious interference with the contract. And, especially if – like, for instance, if you're working at – I mean, even if it's a place like Dick's Sporting Goods or some place where you're making maybe a little bit over minimum wage, if you don't have any – the nice thing is that these people keep lots of records. You can look at your records. If there are no complaints, if you have a good history of employment, then you can essentially say, well, listen, I had no intention of leaving Dick's Sporting Goods. I liked it there. Or wherever the place is. I'm just picking that out of the top of my head. So I could have – potentially work there my entire life. I'm 25 years old. I can retire at 65. That's 40 years. So you owe me 40 years of salary.
Yeah.
And, plus also, whatever, maybe punitive damages for breaking the contract with, because of a protected First Amendment activity, and stuff like that. So it's very simple that it was very easy to sort of, the answer to your question is yes, it's a good theory.
Yeah, and I want to go through some of the elements of tortious interference that you need to establish. One, you need to establish the contract exists, that the interfering party is not part of the contract but knows about it, and that the intention of their action is to break it up to damage you, and that you've been damaged. And in the case of somebody who's has dissident political opinions online and is doxxed, and their employer's information is released, and the employer is contacted, and they are pressured to fire the person, all of these elements apply. They find out about the contract. They intend to break it with the intent to damage you. You can oftentimes use their own. So you should document when you see you, when, if you get doxxed, document everything, document the people that do it, or the accounts that do it, document the response to it, document people that are, say, it's a tweet that puts your information out there, the people that respond to the tweet, what they say, because they're going to say things like, let's get him fired, you know what I mean? And like, this guy will never work again. Like, they'll say things like that. They'll go off the handle with that. And so make sure you get screenshots or archived copies of those tweets from archive.is, or just screenshot them and save them, because that's all going to be useful to you in establishing these facts, which is that these people found out my information and they intended to go and interfere with my contractual my contractual relationships with other people involving me getting money. So it's losing your employment is just about the worst damage anybody can suffer short of physical injury. So that's their intention. They tell you that's their intention. There's articles written. There's theories that they have developed on their blogs about this being their intention. So this is a very easy case to make. And I think that if we hit some of these people with lawsuits regarding this, they will start to get timid, particularly if they're hit with damages, particularly if they find out, oh, I called this guy's employer because I wanted to signal about what a good liberal I am, or what a good leftist or anti-fascist I am. I wanted to join in on this public attack campaign against this one guy, and now I've got to pay him money for doing that. People will back off,
and also it'll make there will be a transactional cost to employers engage in this nonsense, because you see, for example, we were looking at Twitter the other day, and was at BSE or something, the weapons contractor was discussing the situation of an employee that some anonymous –
allegedly. All this is alleged.
Yeah. They were discussing this situation with an anonymous anarchist troll account with 100 followers, just out there willy-nilly. That should be unacceptable, and there probably is even a tort with that. I mean, that is an internal dispute. They were discussing his employment situation over reports of the person's political beliefs, and they're discussing it openly on social media. I mean, that's just what do you think of that, Blackstone?
Well, I mean, so it might be the case that maybe will be like invasion of privacy. You know, it could be false light, perhaps. But you know, I'm not certain about that. I don't know if that would be an independently tortious thing to do. But I would like to point out a very simple thing, which is that the extent to which the pressures on these places exist, it is people calling them, you know, hang up the phone. I mean, I don't understand why like people take other people saying things so seriously. First of all, depending on the kind of store you're working at, if it's a gun store, if it's a sporting goods store, Antifa doesn't shop there anyway. Okay. You know, they're not buying guns. They're not buying, you know, unless you're selling heroin, they're probably not buying it. Right. So there's that. But there's also the fact that you just don't have to listen. I don't understand this bowing to pressure that these employers engage in, and they feel like they need to most people don't give a crap. You know, and no one like the people that really care are these activists who live to do this. And it's not like they're thinking to themselves, like, I can't stand to go to Dick's when there's a Nazi there.
No.
So the average guy is going to go to Dick's and be like, I don't care who's working here. Can he help me? Does he wear a name tag? And so I don't understand, frankly, like, regardless of the legality or illegality of it, I don't understand the lily-livered pussy-lip nonsense that these people engage in, where they just roll over because some people make some mean phone calls. Change your number.
Well, there's a few things that are going on. Is that one, they don't understand. There's people that are at these businesses that there's a possibility that the higher ups in the business agree with these politics. That's a likely possibility. The larger the business is, like a Dick's Sporting Goods, the more likely it is that their board and the CEO and the top level officers of that company are just part of this. They're Hillary Clinton voters, right? That they're globalists themselves. That's their political ideology. So that's one thing. But there's another thing, and also on top of that, all these companies have been either voluntarily or under social pressure, they put out these sort of diversity policies. So they feel like, oh, we have company values, right? But that's all just bullshit. But the other thing is that they have been sort of trained to be deathly afraid of bad press, and they don't understand that nobody cares. They have not been through the cycle. This is assuming that they're decent people at the business, generally speaking, that they're not shitbags already, right? They don't understand how the cycle of this works. Now, those of us that have been doing this for years and have gone through this ourselves and have seen other people go through it, we understand that if there's no response, if these cries and screams that this guy's a Nazi and he works here, and if nothing comes of that, they will stop after a day or two. They'll get tired, they'll get frustrated, they'll get blackpilled, and they'll stop. And it won't be a big deal. Whatever thing comes out, like, all a company really has to do is not respond. Say, we're not responding to that. Like, we don't comment on employees. Like, that's it. Goodbye. See ya. And whatever pressure they try to bring, if they just put up a stone wall of no comment, they're not going to lose a single customer. And they don't understand that. So I think that this is assuming that they're honest, because there's some businesses that the people, like a manager or somebody higher up than that, even is like, oh, there's somebody that I don't like politically that's working here. Well, let's actually destroy them. That's another thing. But
the corporations are 100% on board with the Antifa. That's clear. But
true, but they can be bullied.
But when it comes to, I don't know about that, but when it comes to the smaller businesses that engage in this, where they fire people, like, say, a small construction company or electrician company, I think their fear is more so the mafia-style targeting, where, you know, that you have waves of anarchist trolls going on your Yelp and giving you a one-star review, right? Or you get the media starting to dig for, you know, violations or whatever else. So that's the real fear. It's the kind of – it reminds me a lot of the mafia and the unions, right? Like they used to do strikes and work stoppages and whatever. So in a sense, it's kind of I mean, you can't legally prove this, but it's a form of racketeering and a form of extortion. You either do what we say politically, or we will tank your reviews without reason.
I wouldn't assume you can't prove that. I mean, oftentimes they say this themselves that they'll do that. Also, of course, those I mean, dude. Yelp has a huge problem with businesses that are on there complaining that it actually just they actually want to just be delisted from it, because going on there subjects you to just like false reviews constantly. So like the idea was good, but because there's so many malicious shitbags in this country, yeah. Like that now businesses are just like, take me off, please, because I don't want to be on there. Because if somebody has like a bad day, because you're so much more motivated to review if you're pissed than if you're happy. But also,
there's an entire industry on Fiverr, which is the independent contracting thing online, and they'll pay you $5, like a competitor will pay you $5 to leave bad reviews against their
which that's actually illegal. that's illegal, but that now we're getting
astroturfing.
We're getting far afield. I mean that it does have, they're also, you can also get paid to leave positive reviews, which isn't illegal, and there's businesses that do that. If you're unemployed, you can actually go on Craigslist and get jobs to leave reviews around for and then you'll get cash. But anyway, the point is that yes, they are afraid of that. Look, a lot of people are naive, and they're a little bit afraid of bad press. So they will get intimidated. So I think that let's get back to kind of like legal stuff here. So I think that tortious interference thing is really important for people to understand, because a lot of people think, most important thing for people to understand is they have options. And they're not totally helpless and defenseless, and they're not just at the whims, because you feel like a lot of times what happens is like, and this is something that a lot of people went through a lot of pain and experience to learn and understand and figure out, is that people can't just do whatever the hell they want to you. You know, you do have rights and you do have ways to stand up. And I think that the point of this is to start to assert that, because it will never, if we act like we don't have rights, if we act like we're not legitimate participants in society, like as if we're these undercover agents or something, like, oh, I'm an undercover secret dissident, and if I get caught, then my cover's blown and I'm disavowed, you know, like in Mission Impossible, right?
Yeah.
But you got to stop thinking of yourself like that. Like, no, you're an active member of a society. You have political views that are different than what the mainstream is pushing, but that's totally theoretically.
And also, stop thinking like a conservative, because you know, I see a lot of people that were being shut down. I'm not talking about alt-right people. I'm talking about like InfoWars, Brad Boy types. They're getting their bank accounts shut down. And, you know, the reaction from some people, not all, but a few vocal minorities was, oh, just go set up a community, a credit union.
That's stupid.
And the thing is, like, you know, we have to start thinking in ways where like, no, wait a second. I have a right to open up a bank account. I have a right to use.
I need to break in. I'm sorry. When you sign up for a bank account at any major institution, you basically also sign away your ability. I guarantee you there is a provision in the contract that you sign that says that they can terminate service.
Of course there is. Time. No, no. Sure, but that's
legally,
not,
yes.
But that's
He's
talking about how to think about this. Like you might be right. But I think that, again, when you see things like this, and we talked about imposing costs, so if there's never a cost to a company that just disregards your rights or your status as a person because of your views, then they'll just keep doing it. Particularly, these campaigns will work. So this pushback that we these theories that we're developing and these methods that we're developing to push back against people that suffer this harassment and potentially suffer losses because of it is going to change the paradigm that we've been used to for the last few years. That's what we're trying to do. So any institution or any individual that engages in this is going to have to start to feel worried or wants to engage in it, because right now they've done it with impunity. They have to stop being able to do it with impunity. They can't harass. They can't get people fired. They can't dox. And as soon as costs are imposed, things will start to change. And employers need to be trained as well that you can't respond to this. If you start getting calls from Antifa, actually, that means that there's some hot water here and you're going to want to just stay away. You know, you don't want to put your hand on the burner, so to speak. Like, you want to just, the best thing you can do is status quo, leave it alone, don't answer the phone, and just, because basically it's like, look, we want their thought process to be, okay, we know that this background political war is going on. We are getting contacted from one side about an employee of ours, but that employee is not going to be defenseless should we move against him. So what we want to do is disengage. We want to shut this all down. We don't want it. We're just going to ignore it and move on as if it's not happening. And then you also need to learn that doing that is the best option. That is your most cost-free option, is to ignore their phone calls rather than act on them.
Well, I think one of the things I'd like to do, if we can down the line, or maybe I can do this soon, but is to essentially write a form letter where if someone does get doxxed and they're being called in, it basically explains to the employer that, you know, if you bow to the pressure, you're opening yourself up to liability, to wrongful termination, to, you know, damages, to the bad press that will entail, because, you know, as an employee, I'm not going to let this go. And, you know, like, one of the things I have to caution against, and this is something I've been coming up against with fair amount of frequency, are these people like, oh, I don't want to sue my employer, you know, and, you know, they were nice to me, I feel bad for them, blah, blah, blah. Screw them. They took away your living because they couldn't handle the nasty words of some people who called them.
Never think that. Look, I want to make this clear too. I've seen this as well. I've seen a couple of troubling trends. One is a trend where a person from the other side messages you in private, and you admit things to them. That's bad. You should never respond to those messages. Or if you're going to respond, simply say, like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, leave me alone, or whatever. But I've seen things where people have been contacted by a journalist who's gotten some piece of information about them. Because remember, if they're contacting you, they're fishing for more because they don't have a total confirmation. So just tell them to fuck off. Just ignore it. That's the best thing you can probably do.
You should treat mainstream media people like you would the cops. The less you say, the better.
Yeah, and so particularly if they're kind of holding personal information over your head, because there's nothing you can say to them if they have your personal information. They show you that they have it as kind of like an intimidation thing, and they want to get you to open your mouth. You can't talk them out of doing what they're going to do. You can't talk them out of doxing. You can't talk them out of initiating a harassment campaign against you. So the best thing to do is shut up, because they might not really know fully, and they're testing the waters. They're trying to get you to admit it, and that's the confirmation that they need. So don't ever do that. That's what
it's actually worse than that, because if they do contact you, that means they've essentially communicated to you that they've decided to target you. So don't think you can't, you know, you cannot negotiate with someone who's holding a gun after he's fired a bullet.
Yeah.
Essentially, when they've spoken to you, they've already fired the bullet. They've already made a decision that you need to be unpersoned.
Yes.
So talking to them is not going to behoove you a damn thing. Let them live or die on whatever nonsense they can come up with. And then if they step out of bounds, then we can slap them. But it doesn't, you know, but helping them or talking to them or in any way engaging with them is just an insane idea.
Yeah, document what they've sent to you for sure. Save it, screenshot it, you know, archive it, whatever you're going to do. Document it and document who it is that did it. Save everything, but do not respond and certainly do not confirm any information. On top of that, yes, when dealing with an employer, don't think that because your boss was nice to you last week and you had lunch with him that he's going to give two shits. They will fire you if they feel like they can do that with impunity. They will fire you, and they won't care about how many times you had a pleasant lunch. They won't. They're going to be totally nice to you until the hammer drops. I've seen it so many times.
I'm sorry, Johnny. Yes,
they're going to handle you.
I'm going to have to let you go. I hope it's not personal for you. I have to do. I'm being pressured by the Huffington Post.
Well, they're not going to say
that. We can still be friends.
They're not going to say anything about who's pressuring them or whatever. What they're going to do is they're going to be really friendly. They're going to handle you, and they're going to psychologically exploit your natural desire to not have conflict. your natural desire to have a convivial relationship with them there, and even the possibility, like the any pleasant memories that you might have of friendly interactions, they're going to exploit all of that to get you gone with as little conflict as possible, as soon as possible. Don't sign anything. Don't admit to anything. Don't sign anything, and tell them, you know, basically, this is nonsense. And if you're going to continue this path, I'm going to have to talk to a lawyer before I talk to you about anything with this. Yeah, that will put them on an immediate different footing.
The whole thing about the boss being your friend, that's actually like a management style. They learn this in school.
They're trained in that. It's like
manipulate
training,
their employees so that like their employees are extra loyal for nothing in return, like as if these are your family members or your friends rather than someone who's hiring you to make money. Yeah. Right. So these people, no boss is ever your friend. I don't care who it is, unless it's an actual friend off like someone you know for years. It's not your friend. And just because he wears jeans and a Hawaiian shirt on Friday and calls you bro doesn't mean that this isn't just an elaborate scam or leadership style, as they call it. So, yeah.
In fact, one of the things about the situation is that we are literally in a situation where they're actively, ever since the 80s, they've been actively attempting to obscure the fact that you are expendable.
Yes.
They don't want you to think about that. Right. But I can guarantee you, you're expendable. And they know it, and they just don't want you to know it. They want you to feel comfortable and safe so that, you know, if you slip up, they can fire you because you slipped up. You know, or if you don't slip up, great. But you don't understand that the situation is they're there to make money off of your back. And, you know, if that were laid bare, that would hurt morale. So instead, we all get to engage in this fun little, you know, clown world where you're somehow part of a family. They don't owe you a damn thing, except for what they're contractually obligated to give you. And so,
like an office space. Remember?
Yeah. If you ever think that anybody at work is your friend, go back and read the employee handbook. Most companies, particularly bigger ones, will have one. Go back and read that and see if that's like the kind of thing a friend would do. Because it's not. There's all kinds of shit in there, indemnifying them from any liability and dumping all kinds of liability onto you as an employee. So read your employee handbook. Oftentimes, signing, agreeing to that handbook is part of a contract, but you won't find anything in there, generally speaking, about tweets or statements made online or things like that, or any kind of legal functions that you may attend on your own time or beliefs. Right? You're not going to find stuff like that in there. But you will find stuff in there about how they don't have any liability to you and you have all kinds of obligations to them, and it's not friendly. Okay. And most people don't read it. They just sign it. They're like, whatever, I need the job. You know, let's go forward. And that's usually fine. But, they're not friendly. And they will enforce the terms of that to the limit if and when they think that they need to. So just don't fall for this shitty, you know, post-1960s, you know, management style that they've developed, as Blackstone said, to obscure from you the fact that you could be fired at any moment, to try and keep you docile and happy while you're an employee. And hey, maybe they even have pizza parties on Friday and give you a beer at, you know, on Friday afternoon, and that's part of the whole bullshit. Like, oh, they get bagels Monday morning and a beer and pizza Friday afternoons. It's great. I love it here.
Yeah, I mean, always keep in mind that your boss is if he's not already doing it, your boss is checking off the days on the calendar until he can replace you with an Indian or a Mexican, whatever your color is. He's checking off those days. He's waiting for H-1Bs to get larger or expand, and he's waiting for all these amnesties to go through. So that's your boss. Your boss is not your friend. And just because you guys eat, celebrate Lumberg's birthday or whatever. Doesn't mean that you're.
I mean, if you've ever quit a job,
the people that you work with are your friend either. Also, keep that in mind. Yeah. Never talk politics to your coworkers at work, because you never know who's going to snitch. Especially if you have a lot of women, a lot of soy boys working with you.
Yeah,
anyone could be a snitch.
You can judge.
Don't, in Romania. Let me break in. Unless you have to, don't talk to any women in the workplace at all.
Oh, I thought you just meant ever. Like, yeah, just
No, obviously no, because we need to procreate. But the thing is that, you know, in the workplace, it's just never a good idea.
Women are the ultimate rule enforcers and snitches and things.
They love it. They get off on it. And the fact of the matter is that you don't even have to do anything. I don't want to dox myself, but let me just put it this way. I have in the past been fired because I made someone feel uncomfortable just because I was like, hey, after work, you know, we're colleagues, let's grab a drink and you can tell me about, you know, what you're doing or whatever. And that was like, oh, that made her feel uncomfortable. Therefore, bye. Right. And it's just sort of like, well, yeah, but I didn't. I actually asked. There's accusations that I touched her. No. Were there accusations that I said something? No. It was how she felt. So if your conversation with someone can be judged on the way that someone else how they feel about it, then it's just not a good idea to engage with them in any way, shape, or form. First of all. Second of all, I wanted to point out as a corollary to the earlier thing about the management style is human resources is institutionalized political correctness and progressivism. Yes. They are your enemies. They are coming to get you. If you are called in to a meeting with human resources, it is not going to inure to your benefit. You are adversarial to human resources. They are enemies. And it's just important you keep that in mind. Third is, please don't take anything at face value. Think about, be paranoid, be a sociopath. Think about why someone might be saying something. If someone's saying something like, oh, something is not fair that X, Y, and Z, don't think, that's trying to engage your justice mind, your mind of like weighing and measuring. Oh, well, you know, if X is true, then, you know, Y, it's true that Y is fair or just, and therefore, no. So if someone's making an argument something is fair or something is just or unjust, what they're actually saying is, I want this thing. I'm going to try and get it through using rather than trying to engage your selfish part of your brain, I'm going to try and engage this altruistic part of your brain to deceive you into giving me something that I really shouldn't have. And so whenever someone says something, don't think about what they're saying. Think about what they're saying will get them, and that will give you a much clearer idea of what's going on in any one conversation.
Yeah. This is all really good advice on how to interact. And look, I don't blame anybody for kind of falling for any of this stuff, because it's literally people have put in millions of dollars, billions of dollars, and thousands and hundreds of thousands of hours in training people on these things specifically to trick you. So there's no shame in being tricked, but you have to, you know, we're telling you now how this works and how you should behave in these situations. And the main thing is, you're more important than any of these people. You're the one that's in trouble, not them. They are trying to get rid of you as cleanly and quickly as possible. Don't make it so quick and clean. They're never going to understand. You know, they're never going to take your side. They're never going to empathize. They'll let you talk. That's the other thing. They'll let you talk if you start opening up and telling them stuff about you. They'll let you talk. It's all an act. It's all a way that they are trained to handle you. So don't give them anything. Act in ways that they're not trained to deal with. Be totally self-defensive.
I think when it comes to white collar or middle class professions, you have to be extremely paranoid. Like if you work in construction or you're a waterproofer or something, and you got other guys who are kind of macho like you that work with you, you can make racist jokes or, you know, talk about women or whatever. The stakes are lower there, and there's not a culture of snitching and feminine behavior. But when it comes to these white collar office jobs, the J left is very prominent there. Like Blackstone was saying, the human resources department, I mean, HR essentially exists as a justification for firing straight white men and replacing them with cheap labor, half the cost. That's really what it's all about.
Don't forget, it's also to give people with gender studies degree a job.
Yeah, exactly. It's a sinecure for people with political degrees in political repression, which is gender studies and things like that. And then they use that. They see the workforce as a way to enforce an ideology rather than a group of people that need to be managed quite often.
Please don't mind me breaking in, but they're essentially the largest cost center for any corporation, because if a corporation's purpose is to make money, then they cost the corporation money because they're employees that don't produce, right? So they're a cost center, not a profit center. Second of all, they distract the company from the focus of making money. So insofar as it doesn't matter what it is. I can, if any organization that has a progressive come into it, the first question they ask is, how can we improve the bottom line, or how can we become more efficient? It's, why aren't there more homosexuals here? Why aren't there more women? Why aren't there more black women homosexuals? If we could get a transgender black woman homosexual, that would be really great. How does that help our bottom line? It doesn't, but it makes us more holy. And so they act essentially as priests, right? And they are priests of a secular religion. And they're coming in and they're saying, hey, this is a really nice product you're making. I see you're making a lot of money. How about we introduce people that aren't going to help you make money, probably hurt your ability to make money, but you can feel good about yourselves. And if you don't, we will crucify you.
I think another aspect or factor here is companies use this as a way to shield themselves from criticism and litigation. So, mm-hmm.
It's the corporate equivalent of saying, I have a black friend.
Right. So in the case of that weapons company, I think it's BSC.
This is BSC, quite a remarkable story.
Like, that they build military combat drones. Those things have a 90% civilian casualty rate. So from right out of the gate, your business is questionable.
You're on questionable ethical grounds. They said we're opposed to violence. Did you see that?
Yeah.
You're opposed to violence.
So you build drones that are used to kill women and children, but how do you get good press despite that, right?
Well
you get these institutional J leftists, or you know who's that control the media. They will suppress left wing critics and even some libertarian critics of this behavior, of this business, in exchange for you giving them symbolic gestures like hiring the black gay tranny or so on and so on. It's kind of like a trade-off.
Amazing. That little interaction on Twitter yesterday, and it doesn't matter who the individual in question was. I don't even know who it was, but they were, there was somebody alleging that this company had some evil Nazi working for it. And this was a small account, an account with only a few hundred followers. And the tweet itself that this person made to the company didn't get much play. It got like 2 likes or something like that. And, but the system, the BAE Systems account, which makes, they make tanks and drones and stuff, immediately responded and started explaining itself to this Antifa account. Now, I tweeted at them then, why are you talking about an employee of yours with this random account that it could be affiliated, with a group that's been accused of domestic terrorism? What are you doing? Now, my tweet got hundreds of likes. And
there was no response.
There was zero response. Right? So, and mine got much more play all across Twitter. It was retweeted like all over the place, and it got like hundreds of comments and stuff on it. Yet they didn't respond. And they were, the notification, that Twitter account, the notifications are not really going to be blowing up very much. But you knew it blew up with my tweet much more than it did with the other one. But now it's like, now they're just, they're not going to respond to me. So it's very interesting also from the perspective of Antifa, and that they are not criticizing the military-industrial complex. They are not criticizing these companies. They're not criticizing the system that produces companies that manufacture these kinds of things for a state that goes and uses these kinds of things. They're not criticizing the entire pipeline that creates that system. As long as they fire the Nazi, right, or hire the homosexual or the queer or the whatever, the queer black feminist chick, whatever, as long as they do that, these people are they'll be fine with them. And it's like, you realize you're like an anarchist, supposedly anarcho-communist, whatever, you're talking to one of the worst a company that's one of the worst effects of the capitalist system, one of the worst products of the capitalist system, is these weapons companies. And here you are. Here you are, anarchist, talking to them on friendly terms. In fact, pushing them around. They're acting as adjunct human resources employees for a company that manufactures drones that kills children. And the funniest thing was some guy, so they said, like, we value diversity, we respect all people, religion, genders, identities, and we're against violence. And so... someone was like, how is it that you respect diversity? And some guy's like, well, they make weapons that will kill anybody regardless of race, gender, identity.
See, that's the great thing about bullets is they're colorblind.
Yeah.
These
drone weapons are the most politically correct things ever created.
Oh, yeah. Because
they'll kill anything. Doesn't matter. Total equality.
Right. Well, also the thing is, like, it adds an extra layer between the person firing the gun and the person being killed. So, yeah. Like, Obama can have, like, crazy amounts of drone strikes, and no one's like, oh, he's a warmonger, because there's a space. There's not a troop
he's
on the ground.
He's not ordering troops into battle. Yeah.
Right, exactly, which is an absurd distinction, but whatever, that's fine. But here's the thing that is hilarious about the left. If you look in the 60s, the uproar about Dow Chemical making napalm.
Yeah.
For the Vietnam War, and how the left just, like, you know, just absolutely lost their mind about the fact that Dow was making something that that the United States of America needed to win a war, and the fact that it somehow got some, like, I don't remember them bitching and moaning about the Japanese children that were killed in the nuclear bombs, but, you know, the napalm for the poor Vietnamese communists, that was a problem. Now that Dow has, you know, black people on the board or whatever, they're not talking about it, and it's because there's this tacit agreement where
have black people on the board or not, they're signaling in the right ways.
Right. Well, and I'm so, just saying that as a stand-in.
Yeah, I mean, assuming that Dow Chemical's board is heavily Jewish and probably some WASPs, and I don't know, maybe a black or two, yeah. I don't know. But so, but yeah. I
don't think
napalm was necessary. I don't think the Vietnam War.
No, I don't think necessary that's right either. But the fact that all you need to shield yourself from that criticism is to hire a token black friend
to vow that you're going to fire somebody that's a ideological heretic if they're found out, right?
Right. So I'm sorry. I didn't mean to introduce. I didn't mean to introduce Vietnam politics.
Okay. Yeah, we don't need to. We don't need to go into that.
but here's the additional thing I wanted to mention, and that is that, like, so people often call us fascists. I don't actually think they understand what that means, because what fascism actually is, it's very simple. It's defined. I mean, this is George Carlin talked about it this way. It's when you have the corporations, when you have the commercial. There's three aspects to any society: your social, which is your, you know, private, family, all that stuff, churches. Then you have your commercial, and then you have your governmental. It's when the government and commerce agree to oppress the third is what fascism actually
that's,
is.
That's kind of a straw man definition.
The real fascism, as defined by Mussolini, is simply a third position populism, and it's actually quite hostile to capitalism, especially the concentration of capitalism known as corporations. Corporatism in Italian, corporativismo, means the body. It's essentially a socialist idea where every, you know, the hand feeds the mouth to the stomach and so on. The hand is the working class. The mouth could be, you know, the middle class. The stomach is the state. And the state essentially exists to reconcile contradictions. It has nothing to do with what we have in America, which is actually the real word for that. See, the problem is Noam Chomsky is the one that came up with that phony definition.
Okay, and then I'm sorry.
And fascism. What America is what Mussolini and Hitler said America is, plutocracy. That is essentially the best word that if you take it to the root, defines America, which is a dictatorship of billionaires.
Yeah, okay, fine. We don't need to argue about the definitions of fascism and whatnot.
It does matter, though.
You're right.
It matters, and I'm glad you corrected me. I'm sorry for the misunderstanding, whatever I read. But
no, it's okay.
Yeah. What it comes down to is this. I mean, regardless of what you call it, it's – you have boardrooms signing on to whatever political nonsense the political class wants to push, and in return, the political class makes sure that the rich people stay rich. And if you look at what happened with Goldman Sachs and that during the crisis, it's very clear what's happening. They cover each other's asses. They will make sure that if your bank goes down, they will pay for it with taxpayer money as long as you push their social narrative. I mean, in Pittsburgh, PNC built this massive building, and it almost certainly cost a crap load more than they needed to build to make it green or whatever. But by doing so, they're pushing that environmentalist agenda. Does it help PNC's bottom line? Absolutely not. It doesn't help PNC at all. But what it does do is it ensures that the people in the political class will protect them. If PNC fails, they can get a bailout from the federal government. And that's the point I'm trying to make, is that what people don't see is the fact that the government and high levels of business are in alliance with one another to oppress and to push a certain social narrative that is going to help the bottom line. It's going to help commerce control workers and have pliant citizens so that they can exploit and make them do it and make their citizens do whatever they want to. It's not for your benefit. No one is working for your benefit. The only person working for your benefit is you. Everyone else is working against your benefit.
And legally speaking, the fact that so many of these businesses take money from the state, you know, if there was a lawyer, you know, if the ACLU wasn't getting exactly what they wanted from the corporations, which is, you know, they're basically in lockstep, they would be suing over this. The fact that they get public money in bailout form or in tax subsidies or anything, that could be potentially used to create, in the case of Silicon Valley or Amazon, you know, say, hey, if you're going to take money from the taxpayer, you need to give equal access to the taxpayer.
Yeah, no, this is another thing that it's like, if the ACLU didn't, yeah, if they weren't getting what they wanted, like if the internet suppression was targeted at communists, right, instead of at us, the ACLU would absolutely pull out every trick in the book to attack them. They would say, well, look, you are taking these government subsidies, these tax breaks, and these incentives or whatever. You're in league with the state at many different levels. You lobby Congress. You get favorable legislation. You get all kinds of favors to protect your business from competition and secure markets for you and such. And as such, you are required to abide by the First Amendment. You can't ban communists from your platform. They would immediately be pulling these arguments out. They absolutely would if it was communists that were suffering the censorship. They won't do it because they agree with the censorship. They like the censorship. And they've even come out and said that they like the censorship after Charlottesville. The ACLU basically said, yeah, we're not going to defend people on the right anymore. We're done with that. We did that but now we're done.
And if anyone's curious as to why the so-called right never criticizes big business as they should on these grounds, well, it just came out recently that Google was donating all this money to the National Review, the American Enterprise Institute, all the think tanks, conservative think tanks are getting bribes from Google to not criticize them. I mean, do you really think Google is going to the William F. Buckley dinner and paying $100,000 a plate because they want to sit and talk to fucking David French? No.
No.
That's basic. The dirty little secret about Washington, D.C. is that every single person there has been bought and paid for. There is not a single independent person that is not bought and paid for. It doesn't matter who it is. Like even the Federalist Society, as great as the Federalist Society is, it's A, run by a Jew, and B, it is beholden to the people that pay the bills. If you think that you're going to get a nonprofit organization, which is entirely dependent on the money that especially the board brings in, the board doesn't like something, it's not going to happen. So the President Trump could be like, I want this many judges who do da 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 da, but if the board of the Federal Society doesn't like that judge, the judge is not going to get in.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like these think tanks, the way policy is formulated is ultimately in think tanks. They're the ones that come up with it. And then it filters out to Congress and then to the various office holders and things. But the think tanks are funded by donors, by the wealthy. And they are paid to produce policies that are favorable to the donors that donate. And National Review is not a – I mean, I remember sometime recently somebody had an idea. Let's get – after National Review and after the Covington kids, they're like, let's get their ads cut off. I'm like, they don't run ads.
No.
And National Review is essentially a think tank, a conservative think tank, and they just have donors. They've got rich donors behind the scenes. We know who some of them are, but we don't know who all of them are. Apparently Google is one of them as well. It doesn't surprise me. Same with Heritage, same with AEI. Now, they might produce some policies that you like relative to the kinds of stuff liberal think tanks are coming up with, but they're still paid for, and they're never going to go after the kinds of things that we are now talking about that are interested in. We're never going to go, they're never going to go after serious protections for workers, for employment. They're never going to go after Silicon Valley for not upholding free speech, when there's plenty of arguments that could be used. But they are paid, and the policy and position papers that they're going to produce are not going to be favorable to those things. Because think about it. If you're one of these intellectuals at this thing, you got a pretty cushy job. You're probably making even six figures. Get the hobnob easy around D.C. You get to take cars places. You go to cocktail parties. You meet the best and brightest people. You have like a kind of a cushy – maybe you get an invite to be on a news show occasionally. You're kind of respected. You got a good cushy position. And then you see, well, who's paying the bills? Well, it's Google and that, a few other people like that.
That's what Ann Coulter. Ann Coulter was saying this yesterday in some interview. She said that, well, you know, the reason Americans didn't get the immigration agenda they voted for is because the rich break ranks. They will put aside all their supposed differences to enable the illegal immigration agenda. So you have the Heritage Foundation as part of this. That's like considered a far – by some people, it's considered far right.
That's just hysterical liberals that don't understand what the hell's going on.
It's barely center right.
Yeah, but they support illegal immigration, Cato Institute, all of them. All of them are for mass uncontrolled immigration. And that's the real reason why you can't get any of these policies through in Washington, because these think tanks, they get money in an envelope, and then the politicians get money in an envelope to do what the first people who got the money in an envelope tell them to do.
Well, the thing is about the thing is about those societies, they don't even have to be in an envelope. Google can just give them as much money as they want, and it's totally legal. And it's even above board, because they're not – they're just a think tank,
It's actually – it's can I be honest? It's actually worse than that.
Yeah, be honest. Be as honest
because, as you can. Okay, so look at – so for
Please,
instance
– go on.
so for instance, the Koch brothers who, you know, they're good on some things, I guess. But their big thing is you know, free trade. And the reason why they're into free trade is because they have a lot of businesses overseas, and tariffs would hurt them. It would help the people in America. It doesn't matter to them. They're going to be the ones that beat the drum of, oh, free trade, illegal immigration, and all that stuff. Why? Because they ostensibly justify it by using Austrian economics, which doesn't actually work. But they love to talk about it. And so the Koch Foundation that gives out that money, they have I have been involved in process. So I've kind of given away.
Don't.
Okay. So so the point is that they have these really, really restrictive contracts that when they give you money, if you violate even one of the conditions that they put on the money they give you, they can yank the whole thing away. They essentially buy your existence. You are not allowed to say certain things at the risk of having hundreds of millions of dollars pulled away from you.
So basically, so, the ideological line is in some way enforced by contract with when they give money. Yeah, that makes sense. It doesn't surprise me. Yeah.
And so like you have like George Mason University, who has this massive economics program that's funded almost entirely by the Koch brothers.
Yep.
And it's super free trade. And you're never going to hear how
– That's where Brian Kaplan – oh, God. Mr. Kaplan. Brian Kaplan is like their number one guy there. And he's like, oh, anybody against free trade is just a mouth-breathing moron. Like,
look, he's a communist.
Yeah.
So the thing is, like, and economists are really good at saying things that are true but also irrelevant. Like, it is true that free trade leads to more efficiency.
Well,
Let me finish. It is true that world trade leads to more efficiency in the world economy. That doesn't help people who are getting screwed in the United States of America because of free trade. I mean, just because something's efficient doesn't mean it's going to cause prosperity in a particular place. And so they're able to kind of like pay people here like, oh, that's efficient. Well, then it must be good. No. They're literally snowing you using these grand principles without actually getting into the nitty gritty of the policy of what actually it's going to cost you. And it's going to cost you a hell of a lot.
Yeah, well, I think
the big thing to take away from that too is that they come up, they have the interest first, they come up with the rationalization later. Like the point of a think tank is to rationalize the business interests and the, in some cases, ideological interests of the super elite in America. Like, you know, they're all technicalities. That's why we say, like, on whenever some, you know, libertarian type comes up to me, he's like, no, you don't understand economics. I'm like, you know what, man, you better be getting money from the Koch brothers, because if you're not and you actually believe in this crap, you're a fool. If you're like some manual laborer that believes in this nonsense, you are essentially just you've swallowed a huge line of bullshit.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, the when it comes to economic stuff and the ideological lines that are pushed, understand that it is actually pure ideology, and you are supposed to, as Blackstone said, you are supposed to buy these grand narratives and sacrifice personal interest, family interest, community interest, and national interest to them. And that is how people have been trained to think, because the other side also speaks in grand narratives as well. So it's part of the kosher sandwich. So the dialectic between the think tanks, all funded by a rich elite, oftentimes, you know, Google seems to be giving money to all of them. Right. So this conversation that's happening, the official above board conversation that we shall say could be exemplified by Brookings on the left and Heritage on the right, Google is giving money to both of them. So both of this conversation obviously facilitates Google's interests either way. So you'll have on the right, they're going to talk about deregulation and open markets. Helps Google. On the left, they're going to talk about human rights, open borders. Helps Google. You know, so this is a, and of course, to the extent one side might advocate for a constricted immigration to keep any kind of credibility with the public, they're just never going to get that policy. So that's right. How it all works. This is how the dialectic in Washington works, and it's a kosher dialectic. It's controlled from the top down, and they never let you break out of it and think of it in a different way. And that's why we're here. That's how we're here.
Yeah. You look at one article that was published on the National Review. It was called "Why Antitrust Legislation Isn't the Answer."
Oh yeah. I swear to God. I swear to God. These fucking right wing think tanks. They will. If you come up with an idea of how to fight back effectively, the first thing they're going to say, and Ben Shapiro is part of this, the first thing they're going to say is that's not in line with our values. Look, Goy, we could regulate business and you know, force them to abide by the First Amendment, Google, but that's not our values.
So I wanted to mention two things. First is that if anyone tells you about your values, they're trying to sell you something. The only value you should have is your own personal well-being. And therefore, if someone tries to convince you to allow a massive corporation or a government to do something because it's not your value, then what they're actually saying is sit down, shut up, and let us fuck you. And the second thing I wanted to say was that we were talking about Curtis Yavin said, Leviathan may always move, but he always moves left. There's a reason why things have gotten increasingly progressive despite the quote unquote resistance put up by the right. It's been bought and paid for. Everyone is in on the game. It's always going to move in one direction because everyone is a puppet show, and it's just about making people feel comfortable. Well, I fought the good fight, so even though we move left, I tried my best, and it's the quote unquote will of the people. It's not the will of the people. First of all, the people are stupid, and you can make them will whatever you want them to will. And second of all, if they actually gave a crap about what the people thought, then we would have a wall, we would have good immigration, we would have they don't care. It's not about that. It's about making people think as though what they think matters, when it in fact it doesn't.
Yeah. And you know, these people are also very protective of their money, obviously. The National Review. So some of the top donors of the National Review are figures like Paul Singer. This is like the big homosexual activist. He's a Jewish man, hedge fund banker, fills in all, checks all the boxes of pure evil.
Yeah, he's
Cliff Asness.
Now his mission, now understand this. So Paul Singer's a particularly egregious case, and we can move on. Maybe we can, everyone
yeah,
can
yeah, no,
say
let's
one
not
more
get
thing.
Into the weeds with that. My point
well,
though,
I want to tell the yeah. story, though. I want to tell right. the story to give an example of now the Republican Party, the people that vote for it overwhelmingly, at least as recently as a decade ago, overwhelmingly were opposed to homosexuality on a moral principle, and they expressed that through their opposition to gay marriage. Paul Singer, one guy that's worth about $40 billion or so, very, very wealthy individual. Like, I think he's like the 10th wealthiest man in the world. Or he's up there. He's in, at least in top 15. And he says, I'm going to come in and I want to make the Republican Party tolerant of homosexuality. And he's got billions, so he can do that. Now, think about all the millions of people, tens of millions that vote Republican that are opposed to this. They're morally opposed to this practice, to the idea of it and gay marriage and things associated with that, to that being normalized as something acceptable in society. Now, they've lost that battle, but they've lost the battle because they gave up their party to people like Paul Singer, who will fund people like Paul Ryan, and to some extent, people like Donald Trump, frankly. So he's able to do it. Now, Paul Singer, of course, where doesn't he fund homosexuality? Well, that's another interesting thing to look at. There's another country. There's a certain country where Paul Singer is not funding homosexual advocacy.
Is it Russia?
No, it's actually not. I'll give you one more guess.
Okay. Is it Syria?
No. Interestingly, he wants a lot of homosexuality in Syria.
Is it Israel?
Yes, of course. And that's
Holy
another.
Holy shit!
Yeah, that's another thing. But yeah, I think we've kind of, this is generally the political problem we face, but we want to talk, we went off the rails a little bit, which is fine. It's striking, Mike. That's what we do. We go off on tangents, but I want to talk more. I mean, do you, is there any other legal stuff that
yeah, I wanted to
give a final
last,
word, Striker? Okay, go for it.
I wanted to bring up one last legal thing for Blackstone. And that is, something I've been talking about, which is, you know, figures like Sean King, who put up the names and pictures of random white people and accuse them of
yes.
murder to their thousands of
yes,
followers.
Yes, this is very important.
You know, I don't know about you, Blackstone, but I think that in the Jesse Smollett case, if there was even two white guys within 100 miles of this guy, the FBI or the cops would have picked them up, arrested them. They would be in jail and then taken a while to clear their name. I mean, this is a new trend that's getting worse. I mean, another case was the NAACP accused a white day laborer of sexually assaulting two black children in Grand Rapids. It later came out that this whole thing was a hoax. It was a lie. But this man's name was dragged through the media, dragged through the social media echo chamber. His reputation ruined forever. When you look the man up, you know, it comes up that he sexually assaulted children. And this other guy that he's a suspect for murder. So what are the legal steps someone can take if they're a victim of these blood libels or anti-white hoaxes?
Well, so anyone that repeats a calumny or a slander is guilty of republishing. And so what, I mean, it will be a pain in the ass, but what you can do is you can actually hit them with what in the legal profession we call a nastygram, which is a letter saying, take this down or I'll sue your ass. And since they don't have a leg to stand on because he was acquitted and he, you know, it was all turned out to be a hoax. If they don't do it, he can sue them for defamation and they can't say they didn't know because they have the letter. Right. So you can do that. It's the same thing with social media platforms. You can complain about things that violate. And this is from earlier in the conversation. I did want to mention that the more that they engage, the social media companies engage in selective editing and favoring one group or another, the closer they get to becoming publishers, which means that they're liable for everything that's said on their platform. And the sooner that someone is able to successfully sue under that theory. I haven't quite worked out how that would work, but it should work that you sue them as a publisher because if they're making decisions about what can be said and what can't be said, then they're not just a platform, they're a publisher, in which case everything they say makes them liable underneath responding to superior.
Well, the in the case of Sean King, He doesn't we're not even talking about people that get charged with crimes. We're talking about, for example, another case with Sean King. There was a college girl that was putting up Halloween decorations. Sean King took her name and photograph, blasted it to his thousands of followers on Twitter, and said, this white racist is hanging nooses on her college campus. In the case of the guy he tried to frame for a murder, he said, someone told me this man is a racist. Mm-hmm. And he was seen within like 5 miles of the scene of the crime. I think he killed Jasmine Barnes. That's not the same.
That's serious shit.
Right. So I was actually talking about the guy in Michigan and the two black kids. I hadn't gotten to – I was kind of working backwards.
Gotcha.
So as far as the Sean King thing is, the guy, I mean, just take someone with the balls and the ability to either get the resources or who has the resources to successfully sue the man out of existence. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, like, you can sue him and you can sue the network he works for making unfounded accusations. I mean, it's one thing if you have the facts to back something up, but if you make, again, when you make statements that are, as I said, either A, you know them to be untrue, or B, you are reckless to their truth. And the fact that someone was in within 5 miles of someone being murdered does not mean that in any way, shape, or form you can draw any kind of correlation between that murder and that person's existence. It is circumstantial to the nth degree that that is someone being absolutely reckless as to regards to the truth, and that makes you liable to defamation.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the person in the case of the Jasmine Barnes case, it was there. I think there was a white guy that was in the vicinity and his picture was taken or something, and Sean King blasted it out there saying, like, this is the guy, he's a racist, we know through our networks or whatever, and like something should be done. And it's like, guy, like, what are you doing? Like, this is not this. That's actually, there's a number of real, I think, legal issues with that.
Yeah,
that's total recklessness.
The only reason it merges into criminal, even.
Yeah. Well, the criminal is not for us. We can't do anything about that. The only thing we can do is civil. Put questions of crimes far from your mind. That will not happen. And then the reason why it won't happen is the very reason why he feels comfortable doing what he does, which is to say he does not think that he will face any consequences whatsoever for his behavior.
That
is literally that is pathologically true among everybody on the left that engages in this behavior, that they think they are protected. And the whole concept behind what I'm trying to do and what Augustus is trying to do is trying to make them realize that, oh, actually, no, they're going to be held to the same. We're going to try and hold them to the same standards as anyone else is held to. And also not to forget that here's an important thing. It's expensive as hell to defend a lawsuit. It's especially expensive as hell to defend a lawsuit when the people you're going up against are like people in the legal network like me, where I do this stuff on my spare time for free. I do it because I really don't like what's happening. And so you're going to have to pay some high-priced attorney $400 or $500 an hour to defend you. And it's going to take a better part of a year, which means I hope you feel comfortable spending $250,000 defending a suit. Because even if we lose, you're still out $250,000 and I'm out nothing. I've made you spend $250,000 just to defend yourself from being an asshole. So don't be an asshole. And it's a very simple thing. Like,
That's what I'm saying. I think we gotta. This is the main theory that we're operating on here, and it's a mirror image to the theory that they are operating on, which is that we can. They want to impose costs on us for our political views. They talk about this openly. They're saying we want to make it so, because they've given up the political debate. They know that they can't change minds. So they want to make public expressions of our points of view costly. They want to make it not worth it. They want to make people retreat from the field because they will lose their standing. They'll lose their job, etc. That's their strategy, because they've given up on debate. They know they can't win the debate. That's far gone in the rearview mirror, the ability of them to defend their position through debate. It's raw power now. So if we can start to fight back, I mean, look, then they have extensive networks. They've been building these for a century. Legal foundations, legal aid, using the media to push a message, using institutions, educational institutions, everything. We all know how they've done what they've done to create this matrix of this sort of thing that's smothering our society. But we've got to just start building to fight back. I mean, we have tools at our disposal. It's not hopeless. Like, it's not something that we can't do. Like, we have things that we can use. We have legal theories we can use. We do have standing. You have standing, absolutely. If you're doxxed and harassed and threatened by people, you know, you got to start thinking of yourself. This is what I was trying to go into before. Start thinking of yourself as somebody in society, a citizen with standing and rights that does have a right to these things that can't just be walked all over. You're not a ninja that if they pull your mask off, like you disappear or something. You're not like a,
You're not the bad guy in Scooby-Doo either.
Right. It's not like a cat. Yeah, it's not like a cat and mouse game where when they unmask you lose the game. Like, that's not how this works. You're allowed to have your views. You're allowed to express your views, and you're allowed to speak those views in public, and you're allowed to have a job and a functional role in society as you do it. So don't ever let them think that fundamentally your place is on the outskirts of society because of your views, and that you're not really a part of it. No, you are a part of it. You're an integral part of it, and you deserve to have a functional role and be able to express your views. That's what we're fighting for. And when we do start to defend ourselves legally and say, look, there's a whole bunch of, and you would be amazed. One of the most heartening things happened to me when I started actually looking at some of this legal stuff and realizing, well, wait, that applies to me. That applies to me. That applies to me. Holy shit. Like, there's all this stuff out here that works.
Yeah.
Or could work in our favor.
The reason why this is happening is because people, and they don't realize it, and I'm sympathetic, I really am, but the reason why it's happening is because they tacitly accept mm-hmm. the narrative that is being
exactly.
spun.
Exactly.
And don't, you are the master of your own narrative. You are the hero of your own story. And so you can either be the man or woman, in some rare cases, who buckled and accepted what other people said about them, or you're the guy who stands up and spins a new story about heroically standing up to the bullies that are trying to hold you down. And there are plenty of – listen, all you got to do is just have a little bit of agency, and there are people out there – I can't tell you how many times Augustus will get in touch with me. Oh, there's this guy. We need to talk to him. Oh, there's this guy we need to talk to. I'm actually at the point where I have more lawyers than I know what to do with because I can't manage that number of lawyers without it being my full-time job.
And now, this is the thing I've noticed as well, that there's actually a lot of attorneys have gotten interested in this stuff because they know a little bit about the law and they've seen what's been going on and they don't like it. But a lot of them are also themselves like, well, you know, I'm just one guy. Like, this is kind of bullshit, but what can I do? So let me just continue in my main practice. And, you know, which is, you know, I understand that completely, but that's not how the enemy ever thought. The enemy always thought in terms of let's band together, let's get a bunch of attorneys all on the same page, and let's just start attacking. And so I'm glad to see that's happening now that the organizational structures to recruit these people in, and for a lot of attorneys, I know there's attorneys listening, you know, you can be part of this too, and you don't have to put your name out there. You can help in the background. You can do research. You can write, you can ghostwrite briefs and things like that, and save other people, you know, so that the work is spread out. But you never have to be the attorney of record in any case. So that you can help like that totally behind the scenes without anybody knowing and continue with your main practice. So, and I know there's a lot of attorneys that are interested in that because we've heard so many stories of people that have been like, they've gotten docs or something, and like a lawyer in their area will like reach out and be like, look, here's some things you can do, but like, I don't want to get my name out there because I don't want people coming after me.
And it's not entirely, not every, and again, another thing too that's important to remember here, not everyone who wants to join these groups or support these efforts is alt-right or a white nationalist or anything. There's a lot of people out there,
civil libertarians,
like libertarian types, that see what's going on and know that once the guillotine is out, it comes for everyone. So if you're a lawyer out there listening to this and you're kind of afraid of being connected to your client for your client's politics, which of course, you know, if you're a lawyer defending a child rapist, no one ever does that to you. But if you defend a political dissident, then suddenly you are somehow an accomplice to his ideology or something. But, you know, if you're afraid of that, we need to all start getting over that because ultimately, and I think the only one that really understands this who is Mark Randazza. Ultimately, this is the test case. Once they're able to do this to us, they're going to keep moving along the spectrum.
Well, I mean, we've
until
we've
they finally get to you. And if they don't get to you this generation, they'll get to your children.
Well, and another thing about the lawyers, I would like those that are listening, how long, if you have non-progressive ideas, and there are significant, if not,
there's so many people that have them. That's why they have to suppress it so hard.
Right. So, but the point is this: how long until they come for your job? You have a cushy job at a big law. You know, if you know the score, if they think that you're going to cost them money, they'll drop you like a hack. You know, it doesn't matter if your views were acceptable 5, 10, 15 years ago. They're coming for you eventually.
But there's another aspect too.
So it's in your interest to go ahead and stand up, even if it's, like you said, behind a name. Like my actual name is not Blackstone, obviously. I'm not a 18th century jurisprudential writer.
That's not actually your picture?
No. Although I wish it was. I could
LARP like that. You should.
I would look like that. I would
you
love
should
it.
Go in a court like in the full outfit with the wig and everything. Like
they would probably be like, "What the hell is this crap?" But I mean, well, Elmer did some stuff like that.
Well, no, but in all seriousness, though, you're totally right about that, Blackstone. Like they, you know, I mean, how many people today are being punished for a joke they made 10 years ago?
Yes,
for a political view that was acceptable 10 years, like being against gay marriage was a mainstream
or
view.
joking about transsexualism, like joking about a dude dressed like a lady a decade ago when it was all over Hollywood to do
Doubtfire.
The funniest one is you know, Jim Carrey, who now draws pictures of like children being eviscerated for wearing a Trump hat. He did a movie where he threw up at the prospect of finding that a person dressed as a woman was really a man. that was Ace Ventura, if no one's seen it, which a lot of people
have. My God, if you've seen Ace Ventura 2, like every other scene is a black joke
which
or making
actually
fun of Africans.
It's a freaking funny movie. If you
have. I love that movie.
The movie's actually really
that's
funny.
Why I love it.
But anyway, I also want to say this. The other thing is this, that it's like, how long can you go, and this is maybe, you know, take what you want for it, but if you don't agree with the dominant paradigm in society and you're just going along to get along to keep your income, how long can you be happy with yourself for that? Everybody has an urge, and this is why we get these contacts, and this is why people like listening to our show, and this is why people want to do something, even if behind the scenes, is because everybody has an urge that they don't want to go along with a system that they don't like. Like the ability for people to rationalize, people do get scared about their living, but the ability to just be focused on that and hate everything that's going on around you and seeing the evil of the system and continue to work with it and not do anything is there's a lot of people that can't live with themselves doing that. And they're going to want to reach out and do something to feel like they're resisting in some small way.
There's a lot of intersection here. There's a moral intersection where you feel like you're morally obligated. We have a moral obligation to our country to defend our liberty. And the second is existential. If you're a straight white man, your days are numbered. They tell you every day.
Yeah, they're literally celebrating it in the press.
If you play ball and have a job today, you won't tomorrow, no matter what you do. So now is the time to do something before the sand, the final granules of sand fall down in the clock, right? So ultimately, this is something that had to be done yesterday. But this legal defense group, there's nothing immoral about it. This is purely a question of civil liberties against fighting against these forces that seek to create the new Stalinist Russia, but without any of the good parts like healthcare or law and order and healthcare. Stalin gave you law and order, healthcare, and classical music.
Ethnic homogeneity, too.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say that. I mean, like, Stalin, I'm not a big fan of communism, not even close, but one of the things that he did, which was surprising.
Well, you're on the wrong show. No, I'm just
surprisingly based is after the Great Patriotic War, as they called it, he told – it was considered to be unpatriotic to not have Russian children. If you weren't procreating, you were not doing your bit for Mother Russia. And that's that was right. He was correct to do that. I mean, they had lost so many people, they needed to replenish their population. And so he started to encourage that. Makes perfect sense. And that, and so like, that was something I can approve of. And that's one of the reasons why, if there's any group, I mean, I'm sorry, this is a bit of a tangent, but if there's any group of people who I think will be able to pull themselves out of their demographic rut, is the Japanese. Because if the emperor or whatever comes out and says, okay, we have to start having kids again, it's, you know, they'll do it. Right. And so there's something
to be said. Protecting their race.
Right. Right, exactly. There's something to be said for that kind of collectivism, you know, regardless of what Jordan Peterson says, because, you know, we are not atomized individuals.
You sound like an existentialist.
We exist within the context, our own social context, family, church, nation, peoples. Like, this is not, obviously, I'm probably just preaching to the choir, but it does bear being said that you can be an individual, but being an individual means nothing if you're not part of a group.
Yeah, and no, that's absolutely the case.
The Weinstein brothers, David Rubin and Jordan Peterson, agree that collectivism is good, just not for whites. They agree with collectivism for Israel. I mean, look at how they dogpiled that Muslim woman who criticized AIPAC. Yeah. That was the intellectual dark web doing that.
Intellectual dark web is almost entirely Jewish, and the values that they preach, you know that they are lying to you, because they do not preach these values in the ethnic homeland of Jews, which is Israel. They are perfectly fine with high levels of collectivism that I think a lot of white Gentiles would even be uncomfortable with, that Jews practice in Israel. Where, you know, we're simply saying that, like, and so what they have is you have Jews that come out and they say, you know, these are all fine for Israel. Israel's a military socialist collectivist state that is literally conquering racial enemies on its border. And, you know, but you guys in the Gentile world, you have to have every ordering principle of society torn away from you, from, government to church to family. Every signifier of order and a decent life has to be pulled out from under you. No church, no religion that's decent, no communities, no education, no government. These are all going to be turned and warped against you and turned into principles of disorder and disunity in your country. And we're going to do this on the basis of some kind of morality that celebrates your right to express yourself as sexually, your right to access all the institutions as a minority or something like that. Like, because there's a, you know, because some people are minorities, there cannot be institutions that service anybody. So this is how, this is what they do. This is what they have done throughout history. And that is what is happening to our country. So even the law, we have a law that is based on a principle of order and liberty. That's the theory behind the U.S. law, and you can't access it. But they have turned it and perverted it so much, and you see how that's happened. But we can still access the good parts of it for ourselves. So this is important to do, and if we don't, then they're going to turn this country into it's not even going to be a shithole. It's going to be something worse. It's not even going to be like poor, like that people could live with. It's going to be like twisted.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a hellscape. It's going to essentially look like hell. That's what's going to be. I mean, what is hell except for a bunch of souls who have rejected the light of God and who only look out for themselves? I mean, that's why Brazil's the state it's in. That's why Venezuela's the state it's in. You know, you sacrifice higher. You know, if you sacrifice your higher principles, your greater institutions, your aspirations as a race, as a nation, to the benefit of, you know, being able to put your genitals, you know, wherever you want, then essentially you live in a hellscape, because everyone is just looking out for themselves, and there's no such thing as any kind. I mean, it's one step removed from the state of nature, and that's what they're. But here's the thing about animals: it's really easy to corral them, and that's why they're doing it.
It's like Parrot made a very funny comment on social media. He said, the fact that Donald Trump is now demanding a war for Israel against Iran because they're not gay enough, well, that just convinces me that this life was just it's just a simulation to torture me.
I mean, sometimes you do feel that way when you're a dissident and it seems like the whole system is against you. But the answer to that is solidarity. The answer to that is because look, we can't do it alone. There's no way one guy could fight this system, but we can do it together, and that's why I'm happy with these developments recently. I feel like we've gone through some rough patches, but people have learned their lessons. People have learned very hard and difficult lessons. I certainly have learned a number of very hard and difficult lessons. I think a lot of people has.
Everyone.
And the outcome of this is we're going to now be organizing in a way that is stronger, more effective, and is going to be able to strike some blows. You know, in a metaphorical sense, for our side in this meta ideological struggle that we're involved in.
The name Testudo is a very great name for this project because the Romans developed Testudo as a way to fight outnumbered. So, yes, we are outnumbered. We are surrounded. We are outspent. Not outnumbered in the physical sense. We probably have bigger numbers than at least than the anarchists and communists, for sure.
For sure, we do, yeah.
And so the Testudo is important because if we use our resources efficiently, even if they're fewer than the system, we can actually be very resilient, okay? And I think that's why Augustus Invictus's project and Blackstone's are so important. We need to get as much money and support for these things as humanly possible, despite the deplatforming, despite all the issues, and man, good conscience with legal background to support these endeavors in whatever way you can.
Actually, that's a fantastic tee up for me. Thank you. there's no website for Testudo yet. I'm working on that. But there is a foundation that has agreed to help support us there. It's fairly normy tier, but it is a pro-constitutional First Amendment kind of civil libertarian foundation that has agreed to fund us. So if you go to their website, it's chfcharity.org, and that stands for Cursus Honorum Foundation, chfcharity.org. They have PayPal. They have they're working on Bitcoin. I don't think they have that yet, but they have PayPal. They think they can handle credit cards and that. So, and they also have a PO box. If you want to send in a money order or a check or, you know, gold bullion or whatever, you know, we can handle – they can handle it all. So if people would go to chfcharity.org, they have, I mean, there's just a little bit about them and it, you know, and donate to them. We're trying to raise the money. They're trying to raise the money for us so that we can pursue some of these offensive litigations. And obviously if you, I imagine that
the whole Roman theme, I like it.
Well, there's
nothing wrong with it.
Okay. Yes, that's true. It's fantastic. I love it. I think that Rome.
For those that don't know, the Cursus Honorum was the path towards a social ascension that a Roman citizen would take.
A Roman patrician.
Yeah.
Not a pleb.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes, okay. Yeah. Either way, don't matter.
So in any case, if you could give me money so that I can do this because I don't have the money to fund this on my own. Just to file a lawsuit in federal court is like $1,000, depositions and everything else. It's just going to be an outrageous sum of money.
Costly,
very costly. I promise you that, the money is going to go towards litigation. It's not going to go so that I can have a nice car. I can have a private airplane. So if you give money to like a mega church, give it to me instead. Cause I promise you they have more than enough, and I have none.
Yeah,
and if you think about giving money to the Republican Party or to Trump, give it to him instead.
Yeah, you shouldn't be, even if you're going to go out and just like, you know, cast a ballot for Trump because you don't see another option, like don't bother giving money. Believe me,
don't give
stupid
money. I mean, I think one big mistake in 2016, maybe it wasn't a mistake in retrospect, I don't know, was so many, you know, there was thousands of dollars given to Trump and a lot of it from our movement. And I remember years ago, Stormfront was giving money to Ron Paul. So, you know.
Well, that I think was probably more defensible. But when you bought a MAGA hat, you were giving money to Trump. A lot of people wanted the hat, so whatever. But at least you got the hat. But
right. Yeah, that's fine.
The other thing is this, that you know, there's cases that are being worked on. We can't talk about that because that would be dumb. But there's cases that are being worked on. I have looked at this myself. So if you trust me, believe me that I've looked at what's going on. I've looked this over and I've seen this is a real thing. These guys are really doing that. They're really working on these cases, and cases will come out. So this is not some kind of thing that it's going to go away. Even if, you know, I don't think anybody thinks we would scam them, but I think people might feel like, well, maybe they'll lose steam and it just won't go anywhere. That's not the case here. Actual cases are being worked on. We can't go into specifics for the obvious reasons. But there is litigation that's being pursued. We have plaintiffs, we have defendants. I mean, I say we in like the sense that, you know, I'm not actually officially involved in any of this. I'm just a figure.
We're all in this together.
Yeah. Yes,
anyone
we are
that cares about civil liberties, it's not even just white nationalists or alt-right or anything. Anyone that cares about civil liberties and the right to due process and the fact that you are entitled to make a living regardless of your First Amendment supported activity in the privacy of your home. Anyone that believes in these values, no matter what your background or ideology is, should support this.
Yeah, and think of
this is the real deal. The ACLU isn't going to defend anyone's civil liberties anymore.
Yeah, okay. They've said that
they are for suing some courthouse in rural Mississippi because they have the Ten Commandments outside.
That's what they want to do. Yeah, exactly.
That's the kind of nonsense they do. So they don't care about civil liberties. All right.
Yeah, no, they never really did, but they used to put up a facade, and now they have decided to drop the facade. And the reason they're dropping the facade is because their donors don't demand it anymore. It used to be, now it's always been a Jewish organization, and they've always pushed a far left agenda that was amenable to Jewish interests, but they used to get a lot of Gentile donators that were interested in civil liberties generally, and they would demand that they stood up for the principle of free speech on a principled basis. That demand has since stopped because the Jewish donors that overwhelmingly funded after Charlottesville started seriously pressuring them to not do that anymore. And the Gentile donors that did want them to do that just couldn't outweigh those voices. So, because, you know, I know people in my family were donating like small amounts, and I told them, like, you should write in and protest the fact that they have made this decision. And they would just be like, well, that's not going to do anything. It doesn't matter. I'm like, then why are you still giving them your money?
Right.
So, yeah. And of course, for liberal Gentiles, it's about signaling and things, but whatever.
Can I make another statement real quick? In the vein of what you just said, I will happily make a public position promise right now that I'm happy. I will happily put myself up to be called into account for how I spend every single dollar that's given me. To anyone who has given me money, I am happy to answer for what I do with it, and I will take questions and I will make myself available, because the one thing I do not want to be said about me is that I'm somehow trying to take advantage of people, or I'm somehow just a con artist or anything like that.
We don't even need to defend against
that
charge.
Anyone that would even accuse you of that with absolutely no evidence is probably a shill.
It's just a shill. Probably, they're going to, yeah, we shouldn't
which
even.
We're going to talk about in a second, actually. But anyone who would actually engage in that kind of stuff is just an enemy operative or some kind of moron. And no one listens to these people anymore. People are getting better at spotting.
Yeah, that's the other thing. And this is how I want to close it out. And we've done about 2 hours, but we did say we were going to talk about the lobby. So let's do a little bit on that. I was going to queue up some clips, but we'll just talk about it. And we'll do maybe more extensive deep dive on this later. But for another 15, 20 minutes, let's discuss the lobby. And everybody should watch this documentary on the Israel lobby that came out. It's called The Lobby, obviously. You can find it on the Electronic Intifada YouTube channel. If you watch it, maybe if you want to, also download it to your computer so that it's out there in more than one place, because who knows if that could get shut down. Because I'll tell you one thing, you search for it, you won't find it. You got to go right to you've got to go right to the Electronic Intifada homepage, or right to the URL for the video, which I'll put in the description, because you can't search it and find it. People were doing that yesterday when I was recommending it, and they weren't finding it. So this is a documentary that Al Jazeera did. I had an undercover, a Jewish reporter go undercover, and because he was Jewish, he got information that you wouldn't otherwise get. He went undercover with AIPAC and a number of other, the whole constellation of pro-Israel groups. That by the end of it, it's 4 hours long. By the end of it, I had lost track of all the different groups they were talking about. The David Project, the Israel Initiative, you know, whatever, like whatever, whatever. They've got, they've got just a grab bag full of these.
Israel on campus.
Yeah. Israel on campus. There's so many of them. It's important to know what they are, but it's important to understand how they operate. So the thing that comes out at you, even if you just watch episode one, is if you can remove yourself, and I want to make sure that people understand this, because some of the people that are being targeted are not the kind of people that a right winger would generally be sympathetic with. Remove yourself from that when you watch. Yeah. Don't think about that. And I understand there's a lot of people that might have the reaction.
I'm sympathetic, but yeah.
Yeah, Stryker's more sympathetic than...
I like BDS. I've been a BDS supporter since I was 14.
BDS, sure. In principle, yes, it should be supported. And it should be supported based on the principle that it is causing them this many problems. Based on the amount of money, time, and effort they are pouring into fighting it, on that principle alone, it should be supported. But whatever. There might be some people involved with BDS that a right-winger would... possibly not like. I don't care. That's not important. What matters? Well, we have a certain. You know how our audience is.
I don't think any Strike and Mike listeners need to be told that.
Right.
You know, that,
yes, but I'm going to put this on YouTube, so you know.
Sorry.
Whatever. Just let me do this thing. The point is this: it's an activist organization with a certain goal, and they've had a certain amount of success, and because of that, they drew a reaction from their enemy, which is the State of Israel and the Israel lobby in the United States, which is really an intelligence operation. Okay, they call it the lobby. It's really an intelligence operation. It's not a lobby. One of the things it does is lobby. The other thing it does is bribe, coerce, surveil, harass, and extort. So this is what they do. And the BDS people on the University of California at Davis had a vote in the student body to vote for the university to divest from Israel. Now, they won that vote. Mm-hmm. But as they won that vote, they had the Jewish girl working for the Israeli embassy. So she's a U.S. citizen, probably for strategic reasons does not have Israeli citizenship, but is an employee of the Israeli consulate in that part of California. That's where she's going and reporting back to and from, getting her marching orders on what to do. She is engaging in surveillance with her network of other Jewish students on campus, surveillance of the BDS activists, learning their names, learning personal information about them, giving it to, going back to the Israeli consulate, logging on to a server that she doesn't really understand. She talks about it, she doesn't really understand it. Sending this information and then awaiting instructions to come back from Israel. So she's a foreign spy.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if she totally realized this or if she just doesn't care.
The part where they covered it was at UC Davis. They had they had the BDS legislation. First things first, the Jews on hidden camera were laughing at it. They were saying, purely symbolic. Own all the politicians. We got Israel $38 billion through bribery, bribing the Congress. Ultimately, though, what was fascinating about the BDS thing is that what they're saying is that, okay, we lost this student government vote, but let's make it a costly victory. Yeah. So then they embarked on this massive conspiracy. Again, everyone listening to Strike and Mike knows this is happening. Like, you see a shill on YouTube saying, hey, don't support that guy, he's a Jew, blah, 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 blah. You see that shit, you have a feeling that it's a shill,
yeah.
But you can't prove it, right? So you err on the side of not saying it because you don't want to look like a conspiracy retard. But here, what's so amazing about this documentary is the smoking gun. Yes, Jews are engaging in these conspiracies. They are blackmailing people. They are faking hate crimes. They are controlling the media. There's a scene where one of the AIPAC guys says, Yeah, you know, anytime we need to get a headline out there, I just call up the Washington Post. They'll publish anything I say. And then when Al Jazeera reached the Washington Post, they were, of course, all indignant about it. How dare you? You know, mm-hmm. But, you know, they're bragging about this over drinks on hidden camera. They're saying, you know, one thing that really stood out to me was the professor that was leading the one of the BDS movements, a white leftist professor. And the Jewish conspiracy here, the AIPAC affiliates were creating fake blog posts accusing him of being a sexual harasser of his students. So they actually were. So these people are not even that brilliant. They're just evil and malicious. So in one of the accusations, it actually said, so Professor, what's his name, grabbed me from behind and tried to kiss me as I said, stop. Then he whispered into my ear, and I want you to come to the next Palestinian march.
Yeah, which is like, that's just stupid.
Which is a dead giveaway.
Yeah,
but anyway, the Jew on the hidden camera that was coordinating these psyops said it. He said, well, we do this because we want to distract them. We want this guy to have problems in his marriage, because if he's so caught up in his personal problems, he doesn't have any time to criticize Israel. So he was actually admitting to this. Then there's another scene where the girl, the same girl you were saying that's working with the Israeli government, was actually winking and nodding as she talked about the swastika on the Jewish dorm at UC Davis. She said, well, someone I don't know who isn't me painted a swastika on that dorm, and it was a big deal. And then they showed all the media clips. So the Palestinian student that was at the UC Davis pro BDS rally was saying a bunch of things. She said, one, this swastika was found at 10 a.m. and the media was there at 11 a.m. And two, another Palestinian student involved in BDS said that the Jewish organizations like Canary Mission doxed her, accused her of being a terrorist. And the FBI was breathing down her neck.
Which they throw that accusation at willy-nilly. So what I want to paint a bigger picture of what's going on here. So we have an activist organization. Let's like this, you can even separate out what their activism is for. And it's they're not doing anything illegal or immoral, okay, by the standards of today or whatever. It doesn't matter. But we see techniques that these Jewish groups start using. They use subversion. They use media control. They use anonymous accusations. They throw out words like terrorism. They fuck with your personal life. They try to get they stoke infighting. They try to so it's like and when I see this, I'm like, this all feels very familiar.
You're like,
what had happened here?
What's up? You're missing one thing. They also use a carrot. I think it's And it's not AIPAC. It's the Jewish State Defense League or the JSDL or something like that. Is a massive Jewish think tank slash advocacy organization which is dealing entirely with defense and with defending Israel. And you essentially it is in the national security realm. Especially in Washington D.C., it is one of the highest honors you can get their, I think it's Flame of the Year award, and that it massively increases your chances. Like you getting the imprimatur.
Sure, sure, yes, you're right. That has to deal with how they manipulate Congress. Right now, we're focusing on the way that they attack oppositional activist organizations.
Oh, okay,
because it's important to understand. We could talk about how they influence Congress. That's important as well. That was like episode two. Well, it's kind of like throughout. But right now, it's important to understand.
Yeah, let's focus on that. How they subvert opposition.
Yes, it's important to understand how they go after activists and how these activists responded and weren't prepared for literally saying, hey, I was involved in like a political movement on campus just as a student. And suddenly I have a state intelligence agency breathing down my neck and assisting people in fucking me over. So they have these Jewish students that are surveilling their other students, reporting back to the State of Israel, getting marching orders from trained intelligence operatives on what to do next. And, you know, some of these things probably weren't even caught on him and hidden camera, what they're supposed to do next. So the swastika on the dorm was one thing, the media being there right away. They incite. Now, this is so familiar. Some of the Arab students, after the vote for BDS, started saying Allahu Akbar. Okay, they get that on camera. They make sure that that is what goes out in the media. Now, I'm not saying you have to like Arab students chanting that in an American university, but the point is they got them doing bad optics, right? They got them doing bad optics. They get it on the news.
It's remarkable to the NPI Roman salute. They take
it's exactly
that,
they take a clip, it's exactly analogous to the NPI.
Exactly. They take a clip out of context. And then they blare it all over the media, create a phony narrative. Another thing that really caught my eye was one of the female Muslim students that was leading the BDS movement on the campus, suddenly started getting blog posts and social media posts from anonymous accounts accusing her of drinking all night and having sex with multiple men.
Yeah.
Things that were just,
Where have I seen this before?
Trying to turn the Muslim community against her through this kind of
thing. She goes out and drinks and sleeps with multiple dudes, and it's like this is what they do. They surveil, they find out about your personal life, they start doing attacks, they start spreading rumors, they saturate the web with negative search results on you. They put identifying pages on things like Canary Mission and other blogs that are doxing you, and no one knows who's running that. As it turns out, they actually reveal who runs Canary Mission. It's this wealthy Jew who's worth about $500 million by the name of Abraham.
Israeli.
Abe Milstein is his name.
He's an Israeli real estate. Basically, he was convicted for white-collar crime. He's a felon.
Yeah.
And this man is funding the Canary Mission, and all of these Jewish students like giggle about it. They're like, oh yeah, they hate that stuff when we dox them and we put their information out there and label them as terrorists. And so it totally hurts them when they go and look for jobs and stuff like that. Like, they're laughing about this shit.
So the lesson of the lobby here in terms of this stuff for another dissident movement is see what was done. When you see patterns emerge, you know that there's skullduggery afoot, because I'm telling you, if they're expending Israeli state resources on surveilling those people, I'm sorry to say they're doing it to us. We know.
Absolutely.
Where is the fact that, like, I mean, look, the Israeli intelligence services are legendary for their ability to get shit on anybody. Okay, it's well known, and people, I mean, look, I know it's intimidating, but it's also like, hey, you're doing something that matters on some level, but you got to be able to recognize the techniques that they use. And if you, the most remarkable thing is that the thing that defeats them is solidarity. So there's a scene in the last episode where they're having a BDS conference, and they show up to do a protest to the conference. Now, of course, because they're not really that popular.
Yeah,
total AstroTurf protest, because they're not really very popular. Just like Antifa.
There's a black guy right before when they're on the bus going to the rally. There's a black guy on the hidden camera going, "Yo, if the niggas saw me and Dion working for the Jewish conspiracy, they'd be like, y'all be sellouts." They're like, "What's it cost to buy me? $50,000 and some benefits."
Yep.
Fucking outright says it.
So that's what he's getting paid to be a part of this, AstroTurfed protest group to go and protest against these anti-Israel students. And the funniest thing is during the protest, they show that black guy's face, and he's just like, "What am I doing here?" It's pretty funny, actually. But the point is, though, so they come with a lot of inflammatory accusations. You're a terrorist. You support suicide bombing. And what the BDS kids do, they just don't respond. They turn their backs and they don't respond.
Ignore them.
And they were fucking rustled as fuck. The AstroTurf pro-Israel protesters were rustled, because they're like, if they won't engage, this thing falls flat. And there's a lesson there. There's a lesson there for all of us.
Yep. If you don't engage it, it doesn't work.
It goes beyond not engaging it. What you do is, if you engage in dialogue, you give credence to the idea. If you walk away, it is seen as a complete rejection, and you are seen as the more powerful person, right? you know, and so like not like, like it, don't say I won't dignify that with a response, because saying that dignifies it with a response. Just showing that you won't dignify it with a response communicates that very clearly, and people are like, wow, he's a badass or whatever. So like it's
yeah.
I mean
it, yeah the, it, the it was so much more powerful for them to simply turn their backs and ignore, and they were so mad. The Jewish students and the AstroTurf paid protesters were so mad, and this is like the equivalent of like Antifa. Antifa is not a popular cause. Okay. Yeah. I mean, now there might be some people involved in it.
That was exposed this week, where they had this, they were supposed to throw this big rally across the country, block the wall. Like five people showed up in every protest. Like no one showed up because there's no institutional support behind it. But anyway, yeah. Continue.
Yeah. I mean, Antifa, it's just not a popular cause, and you know, refusal to engage with it. And particularly when, you know, anonymous.
No, I disagree on that, but that, no, I wouldn't make a comparison to Antifa. I think what the most important thing lesson to take here is to ignore the disinformation, to ignore the, yes. the drama stirring. You know, the reason I got this really sinking feeling in my stomach when I watched that thing is because I've seen all of this before.
Yes.
The pot stirring, the drama stirring, the big thing I saw too that really caught my attention is how they use social media. So whenever they put up a picture and a profile and a docs on Canary Mission, they put it on Facebook, and suddenly you get all of these comments, these threatening comments saying, hey, why doesn't the Mossad send her a greeting card? Hey, why don't we? I know where she lives. Let's go find out where she likes to hang out. Like you get all these very threatening, you know, Jews with these implied threats. And of course, you know, if you're a girl, especially if you're a college-aged female, that stuff is going to scare you. And the point of it is to terrorize you into silence. One of them said that after these Jews started pushing these rumors and calumny about her being this alcoholic that fucks all these random men, her parents were pressuring her to stop doing BDS activism. Mm-hmm. Another one was being framed as like there's like a Muslim student organization that has been thoroughly investigated by the FBI. They actually don't have any ties to Hamas, but the Jewish groups go around saying they do anyway. So what they do is they jacket you, right? They terrorist jacket you. So if you're a member of this Muslim anti-Zionist organization, then they try and associate you with terrorist groups, and then you start feeling the heat. Like even if the FBI just visits you and doesn't arrest you because they don't have anything, they'll still be like, hey, listen, I respect your First Amendment right to boycott Israel, but you do know that there are some murky things up there in the organization that you represent. So I'm just warning you that, you know, just watch out for that stuff, because there's people in Hamas that are interested in helping your organization. Just keep an eye on that. And so, you know, if you hear that and you're like a college age student, you get scared. You don't know if they're going to set you up or if they're going to try, you know, you don't know if the next person that approaches you to talk to you about something, if they're an informant, you don't know. And that is why they do this.
You should assume they are.
Yeah. And the thing is with that is that this is, it's the same technique they use on us. You can parallel, you know, make an analogous comparison one-to-one Hamas, neo-Nazis, you know what I mean? Like you can one-to-one make the comparison between the accusations thrown out about us, the methods used against us, and what was used against them. In some cases, it's exactly the same. Accusations of sexual misconduct, accusations of someone's being a drunkard, you know, attempts to morally condemn them, say that their private life isn't what their public life is, and people, you know, stupid people will take that bait, so you've got to not take that kind of bait. You know, things like pressuring you through your family, like they don't care. They are value free. Their only value is the advancement of the Jewish interest. Okay, they don't care about anything else. So if they know your family has progressive values, they'll go after your family to attack your family based on progressive values. They know your family has Islamic values, they'll use those. You know what I mean? They don't care.
Remarkable.
And they don't care about anti-Islam either. They're on one hand, they're happy to push, oh, don't be Islamophobic, Goy, because we need more immigration immigration. We need more non-white immigration. But if they like Islamophobia because it suits Israel's interests at the time, they'll gin it up too. They will be behind all of it.
They're actually complaining about Trump. The Jewish lobbyists, they were saying, oh yeah, you know, Sheldon Adelson gets in a lot of trouble because he's always trying to get us to support Trump, but you know, by and large we don't. And you know, basically what was fascinating is that the woman, the young woman that was the young Jewish woman that was,
I know where you're going, this
leading the conspiracy, was like, I'm like totally against racism and homophobia,
yeah,
and hate.
It was funny. She was talking about, because the guy's like, what do you think of Al Jazeera? And she's like, well, I really like AJ Plus. I like their videos on social issues and like homophobia and racism and all these social issues. I really like that stuff. But then I see the stuff on Israel and I'm just like, wow, makes it really hard to be a liberal.
So there's a backstory to this.
You're such a Jew.
So there's a backstory to why Al Jazeera refused to release this documentary. It was actually leaked to a Palestinian activist group behind the scenes. So I saw something on Russia Today with a few people involved in this documentary. They were basically saying that the Qatar government was afraid that Saudi Arabia would invade them, because this is, remember, Qatar was in a diplomatic crisis with the other Arab states for its ties to Iran and support for Hamas. And the Qatari state was actually blockaded. And so what they're saying is that they were afraid that the Saudis would take military action against them if they were to release this documentary. Another thing they were saying, what I personally think, is that the Qatari government collected all this footage, all these smoking guns of the Jewish conspiracy, and basically used that to blackmail the Jews in Washington into, you know, lifting some of the pressure they're putting on Qatar. That's my theory. I don't know.
I mean, it could be that they didn't. There's even things that they didn't show that they showed the Israelis, and they got some kind of deal or concession. I don't know, but yeah, it's interesting how that it was immediately suppressed. And you know, the thing is, that Jew that went undercover, God knows what happened to him. You know, but it kind of sucks. He put in all that effort and
The reason it's so hard to find hard proof of this stuff is because there are very few Jews willing to do this. Because the reason all these Israeli lobbyists took to this young man so quickly was because he was Jewish. He spoke Yiddish. He was very educated, British accent. And so they immediately took to him and started spilling the beans. They started letting the cats, K-A-T-Z, out of the bag. And you know what the best part is that here's the stunning part. They don't coordinate these conspiracy theories in offices or conferences. They coordinate them over drinks and bars.
It's all none of it. They don't really
off
do
the record.
Online. They don't. I mean, I'm sure they communicate online, but that's all in code speak. It's all sitting in an office where they're fairly confident there's no recordings, or it's in bars where there's a lot of noise around. So many of the hidden camera things were at parties where there's just a lot of people milling around and a lot of noise. It's really interesting how this works. And of course, they have so many organizations, and the organizations throw parties and they invite other organizations. It's all really one big organization. And sometimes the sheer number of the one, and they're all doing the same stuff, or they're specializing in one thing and sharing information with another. It's a very coordinated, it's an intelligence network. And it's an intelligence and psychological operations network on the American public.
Yep.
That's a very important thing. And if they're doing this just because of some students that are saying BDS, which is never going to happen, at least not in this political environment, they're doing it to us. And the other lesson at the very end of it was like, the actual ability of BDS to get a single university or company or business or whatever to divest from Israel is zero. And they know that. But BDS's real effect is the corrosive effect on support for Israel that it's having amongst younger people. And they see that, and that freaks them out, because they're like, that's going to threaten the unqualified support that thus far the United States has given to Israel in the future. And so they think, they're the ones that think this. And now they are seeing the all right. Now, this documentary was mainly made in 2015, 2016, before the alt-right came onto the scene in like a big way. They see the alt-right as the same thing, but on the right, because the one thing that they were confident of in this movie was that the right was going to support them. Even if the left, if the erosion of support for Israel on the left was getting very bad, the right, they were confident, was going to support them. Whites, they can't be confident of that anymore because the alt-right is a more popular youth movement than any kind of conservative bullshit.
Right.
They are now probably freaking out. Holy shit, we have a left and a right movement that is, we have a non-white, heavily non-white and a heavily white movement. Both of these are against us. Like, we've got to really increase our psyops and suppression against the American public.
Yeah. But
the problem with that is that if the more they tighten their grip, the more star systems will slip through their fingers. I mean, the more the mask slips, the more it's behind, you know, the less it's behind the scenes, the more people are going to wake up to the fact that, oh, there's a group of people who are working against my interest. I mean, right. And also, if I could go back real quick and say something about, you were talking about how these monolithic, you know, why there's no evidence of the conspiracy. And I would just like to point out it's the same with any monolithic thing that we're told we should just believe because everyone agrees on it. The environmentalists are the same way. I mean, like, 99% of scientists agree, because if they don't agree, we unperson them and we take away their funding and we feel perfectly comfortable fudging our test results so that we get the results that we want, mm-hmm. but really honestly believe us anyway. Like, if anyone says everyone agrees, I guarantee you that people being what they are and who they are, it's because there's someone saying, if you don't agree, there will be severe negative consequences.
Well, what I think was remarkable too about this documentary is all of the figures that were filmed in the infiltration, all of them tacitly, implicitly, and in some cases explicitly admit that they've lost the argument, that they don't have a leg to stand on. So that's why like some of these people, like the skeptic types, like I respect what they do and whatnot. But, you know, if you think winning the argument is all you need, well, how do you respond to these Jews that are going to blackmail you, smear you, get you fired from your job, put your family in danger? How do you respond to that? Because they understand that they don't have an argument. They understand that there is no good reason why the United States gives Israel $38 billion a year. But they want it anyway because it's in their interest. So they're going to shut you down if you go up against them. And I think what we always talk about with Mike is that they do this with other issues too, whether it's race, whether it's immigration, mm-hmm. whether it's war, whether it's, you know, the Jewish question itself. They know that they don't have an argument. And here's another kicker from that. So one of the figures, one of the commentators on the documentary, was saying that, you know, this is, by the way, this is a few years after it's made, I think. And, he was saying that he knew someone, you know, there is a story. This is like, this documentary, the footage here is newsworthy, right?
It's incredibly newsworthy, but and it was suppressed.
No one in the media has talked about it. Yep. And this guy was saying that he actually knew someone at the New York Times that was writing about it. They pitched the article, got it through somehow, was writing about it. But then like a month later, they backed out. They said, no, we're not publishing this. So this is willfully suppressed. So, you know, yesterday Mike got calls from the media telling him, hey, we got this big story that they're going to subpoena you, blah, blah, blah. You know, just pure, utter bullshit. And yet here we have a wing of the Israeli military coordinating surveillance and defamation and psychological operations against American citizens in the United States through unregistered foreign lobbies.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that for a second. So this is a single issue thing that these groups are focused on, the pro-Israel groups, all these acronyms. And they essentially form a network and intelligence operation, and in order to do psychological operations and intimidate and harass those that go against the Israel part of their agenda. There's equally as many acronym groups fighting racism, and they're doing the same thing. This documentary didn't feature it because, generally speaking, Al Jazeera would agree with that kind of thing, but they are doing it. in the same methods that they have been trained in conspiracy for hundreds of years. This group has developed these methods of conspiracy and subversion as a survival tactic for their group. They are well trained in it, and they know how to do it, and they do it in all aspects, and they do it to us too. The other thing that's remarkable about the thing with the journalism yesterday. So in the Charlottesville case, and this can kind of keep, we can kind of sign off after this because we've done 2.5 hours. In the Charlottesville case, which I was let out of about 8 months ago, there was some motion that was remaining to be decided. The judge decided on it, and it wasn't in my favor. It was I was trying to squash some subpoenas seeking information on the website. In this case, the information has long since been purged and is not available. Like, they wanted visitor records from Cloudflare. It doesn't exist. They're never going to find it. It was purged 3 days after the fact. This is just not there. So they can't get it. But I was fighting this on principle because they shouldn't be allowed to ask for it. Ultimately, after several rounds of disputation, the judge issued his final overruling of my objection. And the plaintiffs sent out a email blast to a list of journalists that they have. I was given a copy of this. Doesn't matter by who. I was given a copy of this, and it was essentially they wrote the story that they wanted the journalists to write. So then I get contacted for comment by a bunch of journalists. One of them I spoke with on the phone, and because I spoke with them on the phone and I've set the record straight. Now, I don't recommend most people talk to journalists. This is a special case. Trust me, I know what I'm doing. He had to not write exactly the story that they had given to him. He had to, because he knew he was being recorded and he knew I was going to publish it, he had to change the story a little bit. So it wasn't that great. And I might have even suppressed more from coming out on this generally, because they had a whole media plan here. And the thing is, these journalists are not doing journalism. They are sitting there waiting to be amplifiers, getting their marching orders from this group of lawyers, which is part of a larger network of anti-racist and anti, you know, homophobic and anti blah, blah, blah groups, right?
Which is exactly what they show in the documentary. Remember the part where they walk out on so on the hidden camera, they say, so when it came to that BDS vote, we knew we were going to lose. We lost that debate. So what we were planning was we were going to bring all the Jewish students into the classroom. And then in the middle of the vote, we got up and we marched out in protest, right? This is all coordinated. So they show after in the documentary, they show like Fox News and
Megyn Kelly and Laura Ingraham.
Megyn Kelly, all of them, they were able to get this to them, and they posted that, like you were saying before, they posted the students walking out while the Arabs were saying Allah Akbar.
And they're saying,
and who knows, maybe some of those Allah Akbar Arabs were actually
who knows where that came
who
from
knows
too. Yeah,
but you know, so the story on Fox Jews was, oh, Jewish students ran out of the classroom by Muslim extremists chanting Allah Akbar. Is this America?
It was. Yeah. And when you see that, that's exactly what they did with the MPI Hailgate thing. It's exactly what the tactic was that they used. It's the same tactic.
I would say more comparable would be the mystery man at Charlottesville with the swastika flag.
Yeah.
After being told specifically, I mean, that guy was not an NSM guy. People have checked. He was not in the
Nobody
NSM.
Knows who he was. Nobody knows who he was. And amazingly,
no one knows.
Amazingly,
and isn't very, you know, he was probably the most egregious Charlottesville marcher of all when it comes to
Nobody knows who he is. No one's looked into it. He hasn't been doxed.
No one is interested. Did you see, hey, that's racist? Did you ever see, I don't know if he ever put that guy's picture up. Said, does anyone recognize him?
No. Nobody sought that guy. Nobody said, who is this guy? It's in every picture. It was on the picture of the article they published yesterday in Courthouse News about this opinion issued in the court case. That picture. Yet nobody has tried to dox that guy. It's quite – and oh, look, a nice fresh creases on the flag. Look, we've done this before. But this is exactly what they do. But I wanted to actually – the point I was making is how the journalists are literally not journalists. They are taking marching orders. They sit there and they never reported on Tyler McGill getting released from the case. Tyler McGill, who faked his who faked that his stroke had something to do with a tiki torch assault that he suffered, which it's been proven he did not suffer such an assault. He made it up. Therefore, he withdrew from the civil case. and he couldn't find another attorney to represent him. So he's just out of it. He's just done. All the allegations made as regards to him are effectively moot. They're not part of the case. So if there's anybody in that case who the only allegations in the complaint are made by him, they should be released because he's drawn to his complaint. Like every defendant should go through that complaint and be like, look, the only allegations in this complaint are made by him. And now he's out of it. So you got to drop me from the case. But on top of that, no reporter wrote about that. Yet here we have a minor little decision on a thing that's irrelevant to the case anyway, because there's no information for them to collect that exists. And they know there's no information for them to collect that exists. They're well aware that the Cloudflare records have long since been purged. What they want is they want journalists, and that's why they wrote this little thing. They wrote this little thing and says, here's essentially basically what you're supposed to write, this list of journalists. And they're supposed to write articles saying everyone coming to TRS is going to get doxxed. And they do that so that they sow the fear, they sow the paranoia.
It's a psyop.
Yeah, it's totally a psyop.
It's also useful for raising money.
Yes, it could. That's part of it. But there's multiple aspects to this because they want to do it. I mean, on some level, they're doing a psyop against old rich Jews, too. Just give us money, right? That's part of it for sure. And that's part of what the Israel lobby does, too. So it's multi-pronged. They're covering all their bases. But I just think it's remarkable. And it's so funny. It's like not a single journalist wanted to comment on Tyler McGill getting released from the case. They didn't even want to report on it. And you know why? They probably didn't even know it was going on. One of these guys, he didn't even know that it happened. You can listen to the call I put up on YouTube with Brad Kuttner. He had no idea that it even happened because he didn't get a marching order. He sits there waiting.
Is that surprising to you? I mean, when you have Donna Brazile colluding with the Clinton campaign for this is something that's been happening for a very long time. Where
it's not surprising, don't really but
do their job anymore. They just wait for other people.
Donna Brazile. It was actually Wasserman Schultz that was the main culprit there. That's Wasserman why she had Schultz. To resign.
Right. Well.
And so the point, what I think is so important about this documentary is once you see the hidden camera footage, once you see them bragging about this, conspiring, talking about it, suddenly all the weird stuff that has no explanation everywhere else but follows this exact pattern, it suddenly makes sense. Suddenly it makes sense why the media suppresses some stories and releases others. Suddenly it makes sense why conservatives are afraid to call out Jussie Smollett as a hoax when it first happened, when it was obvious it was a hoax, but at the same time rush to attack Ilhan Omar for attacking AIPAC. So this whole thing suddenly makes sense, and it only makes sense when you watch this documentary.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for people that had kind of deduced this already, it's not surprising to me that the media is operating this way, but it might be surprising to somebody, which is why we need to keep calling it out. And there might be somebody shocked to learn.
I've been on the JQ for the better part of 10 years now. And
nothing surprising.
It's shocked. No.
Well, the lobby did. Yes. Yeah.
Me. This documentary surprised me, because I always knew but never saw it. Just the ability to see them talking about it, conspiring in secret like they are in such a nefarious, sociopathic and Machiavellian way.
Yeah, literally totally no fucks given for morality or
totally
ethics.
Totally divorced from any morals or ethics or who they hurt or any. The only thing, one thing that does stick out to me, though, that I think is a white pill with this.
They're afraid of getting caught.
They're afraid of getting caught, which means that while they do have institutional support and they are very influential, they're not invincible. So if you're able to meet them on their own terms, they're not as strong as they look. They are largely a paper tiger. Yeah.
Just to jump in, you were saying that there's no morality and concern. It's all Machiavellianism. And, to a certain extent, that's true. But I would point out one thing. That is, they are living, according to Darwin's law, better than anyone else in the Western world right now. They are doing what they think they need to do to keep their genetics and existence and cohesive, and they're doing what they can to defeat those of us who they see as rivals from doing the same. So, and they've been very effective at that. I mean, because, you know, homosexuality, transsexuality, all that stuff, it's all just dysgenic nonsense that's going to weaken our gene pool and strengthen their relative, you know, position. And so from the morality of survival of the fittest, they're doing a fantastic job. Yes. And there's some, I mean, like, you may object to it, but there's some utilitarian logic to that. And so I have a difficult time, like, being like, oh, well, they're not living, you know.
Okay, but here's where exactly that attitude that you're taking is hurting you.
Yes.
Because
they take
because they use those kind of morals against you. So if you want to be in their Machiavellian strategizing, they make all kinds of moral pronouncements to the outside world, all kinds of things that are meant to tap into people's moralities, different kinds of whether it be your sense of justice and fairness or whatever it might be. They use all kinds of rhetoric to tap into that, yet they don't follow it themselves. So if you say, like, well, I think that it's a good thing, there's a certain understandability, there's a certain you can understand why from a sort of a Darwinian perspective what they're doing, it's working, so there can be some admiration for that. They're never going to reciprocate. They're never going to reciprocate that feeling, and it only weakens you if you even have a little bit of sympathy.
It's not that I have sympathy. I want to point out that that's the. So I'm sorry if I misstated.
Well, part of our defense mechanism is our moral outrage at what they're doing.
Exactly.
That's the thing. You got it.
You can't divorce this, because you know what? If pure cold logic was the only deciding factor in anything, they wouldn't even be in power.
They would have been wiped out centuries ago.
Exactly. But there is a moral question here that matters, an ethical question, and that is actually the white strength. The white strength is Thomas Aquinas. It's Plato, it's Aristotle. That is our moral and racial strength that has created Western civilization, the greatest civilization to ever be built, that Jews will never be able to create.
And the thing that will defeat them is showing people that they subvert these exact values.
Exactly.
That's why they're afraid to be seen doing it, because they know they can use them against us. If they can manipulate us into thinking a different thing is going on.
If enough people see them plotting like this, there's going to be a massive uprising against them.
There's two things. One, they're afraid to be seen. They want to be seen as a victim because they want to use that aspect of our morality against us. And they are afraid to be seen as in control. They're afraid to be seen as rich, as manipulating things behind the scenes. And they're afraid to be caught doing these things because they know that the vast majority of whites see that as immoral. And if we see that, if they're exposed as doing that, and if they're exposed as having lied about their victim status, people will be very mad. They might want to take revenge. So they need to keep this delicate narrative that they've constructed in place, and it's very delicate. And they know how delicate it is because they're constantly defending it and they're afraid of exposure. So yes, they are doing it. You're absolutely right that they're following their Darwinian instincts to keep their race alive. And that requires them to subvert
Not to keep their race alive. It's to stay in charge. And there's a big difference, because if they wanted was to keep their race alive, they would go back to being segregated, read their Talmud, and leave people alone. But that's not what they're doing.
No, absolutely.
They want to control everything.
Can I just make very clear?
What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to say, look, this is successful to them because they're adhering to a Darwinian law. As whites need to do the same thing. We need to see that it's our that it's in our interest, and we need to fight on the same playing field. So if I gave off the idea that somehow I was excusing what was going on,
I know what you're saying exactly, but my counterpoint to that is that it's a lot easier to expose these Jews as the monsters and psychopaths they are to the moral white majority than it is to try and convert whites to cold Darwinism. That's just never going to happen.
I got to agree with Stryker, which is that you are thinking on an, and that's fine. I think that there's got to be some people that do think like that amongst our people, but don't try to. What I would advise against would be trying to take that sort of Darwinian logic and understanding that this is on some level like an evolutionary struggle or whatever, if you want to look at it that way. that's a perfectly fine way of looking at it, a framework for a certain type of personality. That's not like the majority feeling in the white population. The majority feeling in the white population is going to be like, fuck these people. What are they doing? You know what I mean? Like, this is not right. You know, people are going to respond to that. And so
that's why when Jews,
I mean, I have that feeling
Jews
appeal
to white. I mean, when the Jews pushed World War II on an unwilling American public, they didn't talk about, you know, Hobbes and Descartes and Descartes and will to power and all that shit. They didn't talk about that. They said, look at these poor little Jews being persecuted, these scrappy little innocent, kind Jews. This is an outrage against human rights and humanity. That's how they won all the whites over, to do the most horrific things. Dresden, Hiroshima, all these fucking monstrous acts of mass murder. That is how Sir Arthur Harris was able to murder 200,000 women and children with his bombing campaign in Dresden and not ever apologize for it. It's because some Jew framed it to him in a way that said, well, you're actually doing it to save the world. You're doing it to save weak people. Because like it or not, that's how whites think. And a lot of right wing types, they lose that. I'm not singling you out specifically, because I understand there are some people that thinking that have their brain is patterned in that way, and that's fine. You know, that's a good thing in many sectors too. But when it comes to populist or mass politics, you're never going to get anywhere with those arguments. That's why, like, all these old white nationalist groups, like creators and all that, they never really got anywhere, never resonated with the masses, because they make those arguments. They're like, okay, this is a natural struggle and, you know, dog eat dog, race war, evolution type of stuff. That doesn't resonate with the average white person. What will resonate, though, is that, hey, look, there's a foreign government spying on you for engaging in your First Amendment rights to criticize this foreign government. And this foreign government has agents all around America, ruining people's personal lives, paying off your politicians. That kind of stuff outrages a lot more people.
Yeah. So I do think the Darwinian, I think it's good. It's helpful to have people that look at it that way, because they can clarify things sometimes for people. I mean, I'm able to go in and out of that mode. Like, I can look at it that way, but then I can also activate my moral sensibilities and get all pissed off. And I find that I'm more effective in propaganda in the latter mode, right, than the cold Darwinistic mode. I mean, Kevin MacDonald's books are very good, and people should read them and educate themselves about them if you have that turn of mind. But then you also need to understand, I mean, even MacDonald himself, though, makes a point of talking about Gentile sensibilities and how those have been exploited and undermined, and how appealing to those things can be a way out, too. So he's not – he's analyzing it scientifically, but he's not totally saying the Darwinian ideology is how we're going to win. He's like, no, we need to understand how whites think and use that. So I think that it is helpful to use a Darwinian framework to observe this stuff and clarify what's going on. But we got to also understand how white people think and feel, and how really in your own self, you have a sense of justice and injustice. And I can tell just from this conversation, and that's going to be a strength too. That's really going to be more of a strength than a Darwinian logic, I think, in the end.
Fair enough. I mean, I guess my thing is that I'm not a very appeals to emotion don't work with me, but I understand that makes me different.
See,
than most
I disagree.
People.
I disagree, because no. Earlier,
I'm saying they don't work
this,
on me.
Okay. They might. Well, they don't work on you depending. But earlier in this conversation, you talked about people rejecting the light of God, and you were very passionate.
All right, fair enough.
So. And I'm not holding that against you. I'm not holding that against you. I like
that's
that.
It's not a flaw.
It's not a flaw.
What? Why do you think the German soldiers in World War II were fighting 10-1 against the Soviets, basically 90% casualty rates, just to save their people, just to save their country? That isn't a cold mathematical calculation you make in your head. That's something that comes out of your heart and your soul. Because, you know, if you want to talk about pure logic, there is no logic in sacrificing your life for a greater good. And yet all these men did that because of their innate sense of justice. So I think that is very important to keep in mind. There's nothing wrong with feeling passion or emotion, even, or even moral
I would say that's like the only way these people can be defeated.
I think, if anything, that's what.
And they're desperately afraid of it. They're desperately afraid of it, which is why they suppress. They try to suppress. When they subvert values like that, if they can, and if they can't, they suppress and they call them evil and they call you out. Like they know, they're well aware that they have had problems in the past with people that believed in, shall we say, the light of God. That this has caused them problems in the past, and so they do not want people passionate about such beliefs. And while
vehicle for morality was religion. Again, I have my very heavy criticisms of Christianity and so on,
particularly
but part of it
as
was
practice
that. And what have they focused so many dollars and lawsuits and energy towards subverting and destroying? It's the Christian civilization. Like it or not, Catholicism, Protestantism, whatever it is. These stalwart parts of a community have been destroyed or infiltrated. Yeah. So the fact that they spent so much energy on that shows you that the Jew is strongest when the white is least moral. Remember Blackstone, the Jews in Poland during the Middle Ages were just as wealthy as the ones today in America, but they had no power. You know why? Because none of the Gentiles in Poland at the time had such a strong moral constitution that it was far more difficult to bribe them. The only ones they could potentially tap into with their money was some of the princes and aristocrats.
Yeah, I wouldn't say
they were cosmopolitan, more rootless. So those people are easier to buy.
Now, I would dispute that they had no power. They had a lot of power, but they didn't have social power. They didn't have cultural power. They were able to make deals with the state, with the princes, with the kings and the monarchs and the aristocrats, make deals with them to tax farm the peasants and things like that and oppress the peasants in that way. But they weren't able to undermine their social values because they were actually kept out of things like the printing press and stuff like that. These people couldn't read, first of all, but they were able to exploit them monetarily, but they couldn't dominate them culturally, and on some level that was more tolerable of a situation, which is that it's like they're taking 20% out of your work, but they're not able to make sure that, like, you know, homosexuals and trannyism and
That's why in Poland, whenever the Jews were caught trafficking girls or, you know, because they used to prostitute little girls. Yeah, the Polish peasants, you know, you might have the official protection of the prince because you paid him, but the Polish peasants would take their fucking pitchforks and their torches and they'd fucking come through your ghetto and beat the shit out of everyone in sight. So that is the distinction between the moral and cultural power and the political, financial, money power. Very different. Today
those
they
two
have
things are merged today.
So we have to take one of those away, and the most realistic one is to take away the cultural power.
Yeah, sure. That's where we can actually have a fighting chance. And today those two things are broadly merged, and people, because of that, people are totally cynical about institutions that are meant to preach morality to you, educational and religious institutions that are supposed to pass on a value set. People are totally cynical about this because they've been totally subverted. So people don't trust this stuff. So, you know, coming out with an authentic moral message is very powerful, and it's one of the reasons they want to come in. One of the reasons they want to destroy us.
Well, I stand corrected. Thank you.
All right. Sorry about that half-hour-long correction.
It's all right. No, we have disagreements, and we live in the world.
I think it was just you were thinking about it, and maybe weren't even self-reflecting on – because you got very passionate, I noticed, when you did talk about people that rejected the light of God, which I admire that. I think that's great.
Yeah.
That's why you're doing what you're doing, and I think that's very powerful, and that's where this stuff – is really coming out of is we have to believe that in our souls that this is the right thing to do. Otherwise, why not just Darwinianly just be like, well, I will survive the fittest if I just submit to the stronger horse here. And you know, my genes can get passed on that way, right? Like
if you want to see the natural Darwinian progression, you know, Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka, is engaging in Darwinian selection by marrying a billionaire Jew power broker,
right?
Jared Kushner. She, you know, so in cold Darwinian terms, you can rationalize anything, even
but that's not helpful to her group. You know, she's creating dysgenics. Yeah,
She reneged, though, and it might be better off for her particular offspring. But yeah, I mean, this is where the Darwinian logic goes. You could argue it either way, right?
Right, exactly.
And so it's sort of like we got to argue on what's morally right. And to us, there's something that to us seems morally outrageous about somebody doing what she did. It seems wrong to us, and there's
morality is foolproof, because morality is, for most people, something ingrained in their racial soul that's inherited. So they can subvert your thoughts. They can change you from being a Bible quoter to a Darwin quoter, and you get the same results anyway, either way. But what they can't really subvert is your inherent moral constitution, because a lot of that comes from instinct. So that is our main advantage, is our moral supremacy against these people. We are moral, and I'm not talking in the stupid conservative way, which is, oh, my principles, but in the confidence in that we are right and that we will be vindicated.
The courage of our convictions.
Exactly.
Moral strength, the ability to understand. This is the one thing, my closing remark, and this is something that I think is very important for everybody to hear, is that when anyone asks the question, who are you to judge? The answer is, I'm a human being with a moral constitution and judgment, and that allows me to make judgments on the behaviors of other people. So if you say, well, you know, what, you're a man, how can you be pro-choice? How can you be pro-life? You're not a woman. You don't know what it goes through. It's because I'm a human being with a moral judgment, and it's not even a right. I have a responsibility to say this is wrong and this is right based on that moral constitution. And so never let anyone undermine the confidence of your ability to make a moral judgment, because that at the very heart of it is the thing that allows us to distinguish and move through this world and to make it a better place. So anyone that tries to say basically essentially that nothing buttery isn't right, everything is the same, or anything that tries to chip away at your moral courage is in essence stealing your power and your ability to do something that you were put on this earth to do, which is to make judgments about right and wrong, and
right,
to live according to those judgments.
I mean, just to see a perfect example, I'll close with this. I mean, look at the conservative movement, the Anglo-liberal conservative movement, right? I mean, it's probably the most technically obsessed, legalistic. You know, it's basically like trivia. Like they have like this for them. Politics is like a trivia game, which is why no one was interested in it until Donald Trump introduced an element of morality and patriotism and emotion into politics. An element, you know, the Donald Trump campaign, not the president, the campaign elicited passions in the American people that I've never in my entire life seen come to the forefront. So he provoked that in people and was able to steal a victory from the jaws of defeat. But the point I'm making here, though, is that the conservative movement has extremely well thought out, logical, cold, calculated arguments for everything. And incidentally, they also have zero moral courage. Like some of the Jews in this documentary actually have a degree of moral courage. On some level, they are risking something. That's why they're so secretive. They are a little, you know, they're taking risks. They're, and it's a degree of moral courage. And you see this on the left too. Like the left has crazy ideas, but they make up for it with moral courage, and they're able to sacrifice themselves to push for a greater good or an agenda, even if it's a stupid one, like, you know, tranny bathrooms or something. They're willing to go into the bathroom, get arrested, go to jail, be bullied by, you know, people in their town or whatever. They're willing to do that. And you know what? 10 years later, now you can't even, quote, dead name someone on the internet. So those moral courage is what gets the goods. Conservatism and hyper-rational, hyper-logical fetishization of empiricism, that gets you nothing. In fact, some of the greatest cowards have that mindset.
Hear, hear.
Oosh. Wow. Okay. Well, on that note, this is a great show. We did 3 hours, guys. So congrats. Yeah. And this was a fun show. Really good show. Thanks, Blackstone. Thanks, Stryker. And
my pleasure.
Everybody donate to the, what is it again? Just call out the organization again.
The Curses of Norm Foundation, chfcharity.org.
Yep. Great. And we'll get that up, and we'll get some, I'll put some links to the lobby, and check out my video I did with Robert Rundo, who is incarcerated. It's on the YouTube channel. I'll put a link to it, and the link to the conversation I had with the journalist yesterday I also put. And so thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next week on Strike and Mike. See ya.
Thanks a million.
See ya. And thanks, Blackstone.
Thank you.
But like dawn light in Black Cell, all darkness will be overthrown. All darkness will be overthrown. Instead, one is given a great gift. Born in darkness and darkest days, he is given trials, mountains to lift. Aye, the very Minotaur in his maze. He is called to be strong, to be swift, a hero upon which his sons gaze. So appear you king, or appear you slave, among the good, or a people strayed, with actions now the future pave. For the coward is he who delayed, product of his age, cradle to grave. But an age makes not, it is man-made. It is man-made.